Ivanhoe, A Romance. Chapter 1. Thus communed these, while to their lowly dome, the full-fed swine returned with evening home, compelled, reluctant, to the several sties, with din obstreperous, and ungrateful cries. Pope's Odyssey. In that pleasant district of Merry England which is watered by the River Don, there extended in ancient times a large forest, covering the greater part of the beautiful hills and valleys which lie between Sheffield and the pleasant town of Doncaster. The remains of this extensive wood are still to be seen at the noble seats of Wentworth, of Warncliffe Park, and around Rotherham. Here haunted of yore the fabulous Dragon of Wantley, here were fought many of the most desperate battles during the Civil Wars of the Roses, and here also flourished in ancient times those bands of gallant outlaws, whose deeds have been rendered so popular in English song. Such being our chief scene, the date of our story refers to a period towards the end of the reign of Richard I, when his return from his long captivity had become an event rather wished than hoped for by his despairing subjects, who were in the meantime subjected to every species of subordinate oppression. The nobles, whose power had become exorbitant during the reign of Stephen, and whom the prudence of Henry II had scarce reduced to some degree of subjection to the crown, had now resumed their ancient license in its utmost extent, despising the feeble interference of the English Council of State, fortifying their castles, increasing the number of their dependents, reducing all around them to a state of vassalage, and striving by every means in their power, to place themselves each at the head of such forces as might enable him to make a figure in the national convulsions which appeared to be impending. The situation of the inferior gentry, or franklins, as they were called, who, by the law and spirit of the English Constitution, were entitled to hold themselves independent of feudal tyranny, became now unusually precarious. If, as was most generally the case, they placed themselves under the protection of any of the petty kings in their vicinity, accepted of feudal offices in his household, or bound themselves by mutual treaties of alliance and protection, to support him in his enterprises, they might indeed purchase temporary repose, but it must be with the sacrifice of that independence which was so dear to every English bosom, and at the certain hazard of being involved as a party in whatever rash expedition the ambition of their protector might lead him to undertake. On the other hand, such and so multiplied were the means of vexation and oppression possessed by the great barons, that they never wanted the pretext, and seldom the will, to harass and pursue, even to the very edge of destruction, any of their less powerful neighbors, who attempted to separate themselves from their authority, and to trust for their protection, during the dangers of the times, to their own inoffensive conduct, and to the laws of the land. A circumstance which greatly tended to enhance the tyranny of the nobility, and the sufferings of the inferior classes, arose from the consequences of the conquest by Duke William of Normandy. Four generations had not sufficed to blend the hostile blood of the Normans and Anglo-Saxons, or to unite, by common language and mutual interests, two hostile races, one of which still felt the elation of triumph, while the other groaned under all the consequences of defeat. The power had been completely placed in the hands of the Norman nobility, by the event of the Battle of Hastings, and it had been used, as our histories assure us, with no moderate hand. The whole race of Saxon princes and nobles had been extirpated or disinherited, with few or no exceptions, nor were the numbers great who possessed land in the country of their fathers, even as proprietors of the second, or of yet inferior classes. The royal policy had long been to weaken, by every means, legal or illegal, the strength of a part of the population which was justly considered as nourishing the most inveterate antipathy to their victor. All the monarchs of the Norman race had shown the most marked predilection for their Norman subjects, the laws of the chase, and many others equally unknown to the milder and more free spirit of the Saxon constitution, had been fixed upon the necks of the subjugated inhabitants, to add weight, as it were, to the feudal chains with which they were loaded. At court, and in the castles of the great nobles, where the pomp and state of a court was emulated, Norman French was the only language employed. In courts of law, the pleadings and judgments were delivered in the same tongue. In short, French was the language of honor, of chivalry, and even of justice, while the far more manly and expressive Anglo-Saxon was abandoned to the use of rustics and hinds, who knew no other. Still, however, the necessary intercourse between the lords of the soil, and those oppressed inferior beings by whom that soil was cultivated, occasioned the gradual formation of a dialect, compounded betwixt the French and the Anglo-Saxon, in which they could render themselves mutually intelligible to each other, and from this necessity arose by degrees the structure of our present English language, in which the speech of the victors and the vanquished have been so happily blended together, and which has since been so richly improved by importations from the classical languages, and from those spoken by the southern nations of Europe. This state of things I have thought it necessary to premise for the information of the general reader, who might be apt to forget, that, Although no great historical events, such as war or insurrection, mark the existence of the Anglo-Saxons as a separate people subsequent to the reign of William II, yet the great national distinctions betwixt them and their conquerors, the recollection of what they had formerly been, and to what they were now reduced, continued down to the reign of Edward III, to keep open the wounds which the conquest had inflicted, and to maintain a line of separation betwixt the descendants of the victor Normans and the vanquished Saxons. The sun was setting upon one of the rich grassy glades of that forest, which we have mentioned in the beginning of the chapter. Hundreds of broad-headed, short-stemmed, wide-branched oaks, which had witnessed perhaps the stately march of the Roman soldiery, flung their gnarled arms over a thick carpet of the most delicious green sward. In some places they were intermingled with beeches, hollies, and copsewood of various descriptions, so closely as totally to intercept the level beams of the sinking sun. In others they receded from each other, forming those long sweeping vistas, in the intricacy of which the eye delights to lose itself, while imagination considers them as the paths to yet wilder scenes of sylvan solitude. Here the red rays of the sun shot a broken and discolored light, that partially hung upon the shattered boughs and mossy trunks of the trees, and there they illuminated in brilliant patches the portions of turf to which they made their way. A considerable open space, in the midst of this glade, seemed formerly to have been dedicated to the rites of druidical superstition, for, on the summit of a hillock, so regular as to seem artificial, there still remained part of a circle of rough unhewn stones, of large dimensions. Seven stood upright, the rest had been dislodged from their places, probably by the zeal of some convert to Christianity, and lay, some prostrate near their former site, and others on the side of the hill. One large stone only had found its way to the bottom, and in stopping the course of a small brook, which glided smoothly round the foot of the eminence, gave, by its opposition, a feeble voice of murmur to the placid and elsewhere silent streamlet. The human figures which completed this landscape were number two, partaking, in their dress and appearance, of that wild and rustic character which belonged to the woodlands of the West Riding of Yorkshire at that early period. The eldest of these men had a stern, savage, and wild aspect. His garment was of the simplest form imaginable, being a close jacket with sleeves, composed of the tan skin of some animal, on which the hair had been originally left, but which had been worn off in so many places, that it would have been difficult to distinguish from the patches that remained, to what creature the fur had belonged. This primeval vestment reached from the throat to the knees, and served at once all the usual purposes of body clothing. There was no wider opening at the collar, than was necessary to admit the passage of the head, from which it may be inferred, that it was put on by slipping it over the head and shoulders, in the manner of a modern shirt, or ancient hauberk. Sandals, bound with thongs made of boar's hide, protected the feet, and a roll of thin leather was twined artificially round the legs, and, ascending above the calf, left the knees bare, like those of a Scottish Highlander. To make the jacket sit yet more close to the body, it was gathered at the middle by a broad leathern belt, secured by a brass buckle, to one side of which was attached a sort of scrip, and to the other a ram's horn, accoutred with a mouthpiece, for the purpose of blowing. In the same belt was stuck one of those long, broad, sharp-pointed, and two-edged knives, with a buck's horn handle, which were fabricated in the neighborhood, and bore even at this early period the name of a Sheffield whittle. The man had no covering upon his head, which was only defended by his own thick hair, matted and twisted together, and scorched by the influence of the sun into a rusty dark red color, forming a contrast with the overgrown beard upon his cheeks, which was rather of a yellow or amber hue. One part of his dress only remains, but it is too remarkable to be suppressed. It was a brass ring, resembling a dog's collar, but without any opening, and soldered fast round his neck, so loose as to form no impediment to his breathing, yet so tight as to be incapable of being removed, excepting by the use of the file. On this singular gorget was engraved, in Saxon characters, an inscription of the following purport: Gurth, the son of Beowulf, is the born thrall of Cedric of Rotherwood. Beside the swineherd, for such was Gurth's occupation, was seated, upon one of the fallen druidical monuments, a person about 10 years younger in appearance, and whose dress, though resembling his companion's in form, was of better materials, and of a more fantastic appearance. His jacket had been stained of a bright purple hue, upon which there had been some attempt to paint grotesque ornaments in different colors. To the jacket he added a short cloak, which scarcely reached halfway down his thigh. It was of crimson cloth, though a good deal soiled, lined with bright yellow, and as he could transfer it from one shoulder to the other, or at his pleasure draw it all around him, its width, contrasted with its want of longitude, formed a fantastic piece of drapery. He had thin silver bracelets upon his arms, and on his neck a collar of the same metal bearing the inscription, Wamba, the son of Witless, is the thrall of Cedric of Rotherwood. This personage had the same sort of sandals with his companion, but instead of the roll of leather thong, his legs were cased in a sort of gaiters, of which one was red and the other yellow. He was provided also with a cap, having around it more than one bell, about the size of those attached to hawks, which jingled as he turned his head to one side or other, and as he seldom remained a minute in the same posture, the sound might be considered as incessant. Around the edge of this cap was a stiff bandeau of leather, cut at the top into openwork, resembling a coronet, while a prolonged bag rose from within it, and fell down on one shoulder like an old-fashioned nightcap, or a jelly bag, or the headgear of a modern hussar. It was to this part of the cap that the bells were attached, which circumstance, as well as the shape of his headdress, and his own half-crazed, half-cunning expression of countenance, sufficiently pointed him out as belonging to the race of domestic clowns or jesters, maintained in the houses of the wealthy, to help away the tedium of those lingering hours which they were obliged to spend within doors. He bore, like his companion, a scrip, attached to his belt, but had neither horn nor knife, being probably considered as belonging to a class whom it is esteemed dangerous to entrust with etched tools. In place of these, he was equipped with a sort of lath, resembling that with which Harlequin operates his wonders upon the modern stage. The outward appearance of these two men formed scarce a stronger contrast than their look and demeanor. That of the serf, or bondsman, was sad and sullen, his aspect was bent on the ground with an appearance of deep dejection, which might be almost construed into apathy, had not the fire which occasionally sparkled in his red eye manifested that there slumbered, under the appearance of sullen despondency, a sense of oppression, and a disposition to resistance. The looks of Wamba, on the other hand, indicated, as usual with his class, a sort of vacant curiosity, and fidgety impatience of any posture of repose, together with the utmost self-satisfaction respecting his own situation, and the appearance which he made. The dialogue which they maintained between them, was carried on in Anglo-Saxon, which, as we said before, was universally spoken by the inferior classes, excepting the Norman soldiers, and the immediate personal dependents of the great feudal nobles. But to give their conversation in the original would convey but little information to the modern reader, for whose benefit we beg to offer the following translation. "The curse of Saint Withold upon these infernal porkers," said the swineherd, after blowing his horn obstreperously, to collect together the scattered herd of swine, which, answering his call with notes equally melodious, made, however, no haste to remove themselves from the luxurious banquet of beech mast and acorns on which they had fattened, or to forsake the marshy banks of the rivulet, where several of them, half plunged in mud, lay stretched at their ease, altogether regardless of the voice of their keeper. "The curse of Saint Withold upon them and upon me," said Gurth, "if the two-legged wolf snap not up some of them ere nightfall, I am no true man. Here, fangs. Fangs." He ejaculated at the top of his voice to a ragged wolfish-looking dog, a sort of lurcher, half-mastiff, half-greyhound, which ran limping about as if with the purpose of seconding his master and collecting the refractory grunters, but which, in fact, from misapprehension of the swineherd's signals, ignorance of his own duty, or malice prepense, only drove them hither and thither, and increased the evil which he seemed to design to remedy. "A devil draw the teeth of him," said Gurth, "and the mother of mischief confound the ranger of the forest, that cuts the foreclaws off our dogs, and makes them unfit for their trade. 8. Wamba, up and help me, and thou best a man, take a turn round the back of the hill to gain the wind on them, and when thou'st got the weather gauge, thou mayst drive them before thee as gently as so many innocent lambs." "Truly," said Wamba, without stirring from the spot, "I have consulted my legs upon this matter, and they are altogether of opinion, that to carry my gay garments through these sloughs, would be an act of unfriendship to my sovereign person and royal wardrobe. Wherefore, Gurth, I advise thee to call off Fangs, and lead the herd to their destiny, which, whether they meet with bands of traveling soldiers, or of outlaws, or of wandering pilgrims, can be little else than to be converted into Normans before morning, to thy no small ease and comfort." "The swine turn Normans to my comfort," quoth Gurth, "expound that to me, Wamba, for my brain is too dull, and my mind too vexed, to read riddles." "Why, how call you those grunting brutes running about on their four legs?" demanded Wamba. "Swine, fool, swine," said the herd, "every fool knows that." "And swine is good Saxon," said the jester, "but how call you the sow when she is flayed, and drawn, and quartered, and hung up by the heels, like a traitor?" "Pork," answered the swineherd. "I am very glad every fool knows that too," said Wamba, "and pork, I think, is good Norman French, and so when the brute lives, and is in the charge of a Saxon slave, she goes by her Saxon name, but becomes an Orman, and is called pork, When she is carried to the castle hall to feast among the nobles, "What dost thou think of this, friend Girth, huh? It is but too true doctrine, friend Wamba, however it got into thy fool's pate."
"Nay, I can tell you more," said Wamba, in the same tone, "there is old Aldermanox continues to hold his Saxon epithet, while he is under the charge of serfs and bondsmen such as thou, but becomes Beef, a fiery French gallant, when he arrives before the worshipful jaws that are destined to consume him. Mine heir Calf, too, becomes Monsieur de Vaux in the like manner. He is Saxon when he requires tendance, and takes a Norman name when he becomes matter of enjoyment."
"By St. Dunstan," answered Girth, "thou speakest but sad truths. Little is left to us but the air we breathe, and that appears to have been reserved with much hesitation, solely for the purpose of enabling us to endure the tasks they lay upon our shoulders. The finest and the fattest is for their board, the loveliest is for their couch, the best and bravest supply their foreign masters with soldiers, and whiten distant lands with their bones, leaving few here who have either will or the power to protect the unfortunate Saxon. God's blessing on our master Cedric, he hath done the work of a man in standing in the gap, but Reginald Front de Boeuf is coming down to this country in person, and we shall soon see how little Cedric's trouble will avail him. Here, here," he exclaimed again, raising his voice, "so ho! So ho! Well done, Fangs! Thou hast them all before thee now, and bring'st them on bravely, lad."
"Girth," said the jester, "I know thou thinkest me a fool, or thou wouldst not be so rash in putting thy head into my mouth. One word to Reginald Front de Boeuf, or Philip de Malvoisin, that thou hast spoken treason against the Norman, and thou art but a castaway swineherd, thou wouldst waver on one of these trees as a terror to all evil speakers against dignities."
"Dog, thou wouldst not betray me," said Girth, "after having led me on to speak so much at disadvantage?"
"Betray thee?" answered the jester, "no, that were the trick of a wise man. A fool cannot half so well help himself but soft, whom have we here?" he said, listening to the trampling of several horses which became then audible.
"Never mind whom," answered Girth, who had now got his herd before him, and, with the aid of Fangs, was driving them down one of the long dim vistas which we have endeavored to describe.
"Nay, but I must see the riders," answered Wamba, "perhaps they are come from Fairyland with a message from King Oberon."
"A murrain take thee," rejoined the swineherd, "wilt thou talk of such things, while a terrible storm of thunder and lightning is raging within a few miles of us? Hark, how the thunder rumbles! And for summer rain, I never saw such broad downright flat drops fall out of the clouds. The oaks, too, notwithstanding the calm weather, sob and creak with their great boughs as if announcing a tempest. Thou canst play the rational if thou wilt, credit me for once, and let us home ere the storm begins to rage, for the night will be fearful."
Wamba seemed to feel the force of this appeal, and accompanied his companion, who began his journey after catching up a long quarterstaff which lay upon the grass beside him. This second Eumaeus strode hastily down the forest glade, driving before him, with the assistance of Fangs, the whole herd of his inharmonious charge.
Chapter 2.
A monk there was, a fair for the maestry, an outrider that loved venery, a manly man, to be an abbatable, full many a dainty horse had he in stable, and when he rode, men might his bridle hear jingling in a whistling wind as clear, and eke as loud, as doth the chapelle bell, there as this lord was keeper of the cell.
Chaucer.
Notwithstanding the occasional exhortation and chiding of his companion, the noise of the horseman's feet continuing to approach, Wamba could not be prevented from lingering occasionally on the road, upon every pretense which occurred, now catching from the hazel a cluster of half-ripe nuts, and now turning his head to leer after a cottage maiden who crossed their path. The horseman, therefore, soon overtook them on the road. Their numbers amounted to 10 men, of whom the two who rode foremost seemed to be persons of considerable importance, and the others their attendants. It was not difficult to ascertain the condition and character of one of these personages. He was obviously an ecclesiastic of high rank, his dress was that of a Cistercian monk, but composed of materials much finer than those which the rule of that order admitted. His mantle and hood were of the best Flanders cloth, and fell in ample, and not ungraceful folds, around a handsome, though somewhat corpulent person. His countenance bore as little the marks of self-denial, as his habit indicated contempt of worldly splendor. His features might have been called good, had there not lurked under the penthouse of his eye, that sly epicurean twinkle which indicates the cautious voluptuary. In other respects, his profession and situation had taught him a ready command over his countenance, which he could contract at pleasure into solemnity, although its natural expression was that of good-humored social indulgence. In defiance of conventual rules, and the edicts of popes and councils, the sleeves of this dignitary were lined and turned up with rich furs,
his mantle secured at the throat with a golden clasp, and the whole dress proper to his order as much refined upon and ornamented, as that of a Quaker beauty of the present day, who, while she retains the garb and costume of her sect continues to give to its simplicity, by the choice of materials and the mode of disposing them, a certain air of coquettish attraction, savoring but too much of the vanities of the world. This worthy churchman rode upon a well-fed ambling mule, whose furniture was highly decorated, and whose bridle, according to the fashion of the day, was ornamented with silver bells. In his seat he had nothing of the awkwardness of the convent, but displayed the easy and habitual grace of a well-trained horseman. Indeed, it seemed that so humble a conveyance as a mule, in however good case, and however well broken to a pleasant and accommodating amble, was only used by the gallant monk for traveling on the road. A lay brother, one of those who followed in the train, had, for his use on other occasions, one of the most handsome Spanish jennets ever bred in Andalusia, which merchants used at that time to import, with great trouble and risk, for the use of persons of wealth and distinction. The saddle and housings of this superb palfrey were covered by a long footcloth, which reached nearly to the ground, and on which were richly embroidered mitres, crosses, and other ecclesiastical emblems. Another lay brother led a sumpter mule, loaded probably with his superior's baggage, and two monks of his own order, of inferior station, rode together in the rear, laughing and conversing with each other, without taking much notice of the other members of the cavalcade. The companion of the church dignitary was a man past 40, thin, strong, tall, and muscular, an athletic figure, which long fatigue and constant exercise seemed to have left none of the softer part of the human form, having reduced the whole to brawn, bones, and sinews, which had sustained a thousand toils, and were ready to dare a thousand more. His head was covered with a scarlet cap, faced with fur of that kind which the French call mortier, from its resemblance to the shape of an inverted mortar. His countenance was therefore fully displayed, and its expression was calculated to impress a degree of awe, if not of fear, upon strangers. High features, naturally strong and powerfully expressive, had been burned almost into negro blackness by constant exposure to the tropical sun, and might, in their ordinary state, be said to slumber after the storm of passion had passed away, but the projection of the veins of the forehead, the readiness with which the upper lip and its thick black mustaches quivered upon the slightest emotion, plainly intimated that the tempest might be again and easily awakened. His keen, piercing, dark eyes, told in every glance a history of difficulties subdued, and dangers dared, and seemed to challenge opposition to his wishes, for the pleasure of sweeping it from his road by a determined exertion of courage and of will. A deep scar on his brow gave additional sternness to his countenance, and a sinister expression to one of his eyes, which had been slightly injured on the same occasion, and of which the vision, though perfect, was in a slight and partial degree distorted. The upper dress of this personage resembled that of his companion in shape, being a long monastic mantle, but the color, being scarlet, showed that he did not belong to any of the four regular orders of monks. On the right shoulder of the mantle there was cut, in white cloth, a cross of a peculiar form. This upper robe concealed what at first view seemed rather inconsistent with its form, a shirt, namely, of linked mail, with sleeves and gloves of the same, curiously plated and interwoven, as flexible to the body as those which are now wrought in the stocking loom, out of less obdurate materials. The forepart of his thighs, where the folds of his mantle permitted them to be seen, were also covered with linked mail, the knees and feet were defended by splints, or thin plates of steel, ingeniously jointed upon each other, and mail hose, reaching from the ankle to the knee, effectually protected the legs, and completed the rider's defensive armor. In his girdle he wore a long and double-edged dagger, which was the only offensive weapon about his person. He rode, not a mule, like his companion, but a strong hackney for the road, to save his gallant warhorse, which a squire led behind, fully accoutred for battle, with a chamfron or plated headpiece upon his head, having a short spike projecting from the front. On one side of the saddle hung a short battle axe, richly inlaid with damascene carving, on the other the rider's plumed headpiece and hood of mail, with a long two-handed sword, used by the chivalry of the period. A second squire held aloft his master's lance, from the extremity of which fluttered a small banderole, or streamer, bearing a cross of the same form with that embroidered upon his cloak. He also carried his small triangular shield, broad enough at the top to protect the breast, and from thence diminishing to a point. It was covered with a scarlet cloth, which prevented the device from being seen. These two squires were followed by two attendants, whose dark visages, white turbans, and the oriental form of their garments, showed them to be natives of some distant eastern country. 9. The whole appearance of this warrior and his retinue was wild and outlandish. The dress of his squires was gorgeous,
and his eastern attendants wore silver collars round their throats, and bracelets of the same metal upon their swarthy arms and legs, of which the former were naked from the elbow, and the latter from mid-leg to ankle. Silk and embroidery distinguished their dresses, and marked the wealth and importance of their master, forming, at the same time, a striking contrast with the martial simplicity of his own attire. They were armed with crooked sabers, having the hilt and baldric inlaid with gold, and matched with Turkish daggers of yet more costly workmanship. Each of them bore at his saddle bow a bundle of darts or javelins, about 4 feet in length, having sharp steel heads, a weapon much in use among the Saracens, and of which the memory is yet preserved in the martial exercise called El Jarad, still practiced in the eastern countries. The steeds of these attendants were in appearance as foreign as their riders. They were of Saracen origin, and consequently of Arabian descent, and their fine slender limbs, small fetlocks, thin manes, and easy springy motion, formed a marked contrast with the large jointed, heavy horses, of which the race was cultivated in Flanders and in Normandy, for mounting the men-at-arms of the period in all the panoply of plate and mail, and which, placed by the side of those eastern coursers, might have passed for a personification of substance and of shadow. The singular appearance of this cavalcade not only attracted the curiosity of Wamba, but excited even that of his less volatile companion. The monk he instantly knew to be the prior of Jorvalk's Abbey, well known for many miles around as a lover of the chase, of the banquet, and, if fame did him not wrong, of otherworldly pleasures still more inconsistent with his monastic vows. Yet so loose were the ideas of the times respecting the conduct of the clergy, whether secular or regular, that the prior Aymer maintained a fair character in the neighborhood of his abbey. His free and jovial temper, and the readiness with which he granted absolution from all ordinary delinquencies, rendered him a favorite among the nobility and principal gentry, to several of whom he was allied by birth, being of a distinguished Norman family. The ladies, in particular, were not disposed to scan too nicely the morals of a man who was a professed admirer of their sex, and who possessed many means of dispelling the ennui which was too apt to intrude upon the halls and bowers of an ancient feudal castle. The prior mingled in the sports of the field with more than due eagerness, and was allowed to possess the best-trained hawks, and the fleetest greyhounds in the North Riding, circumstances which strongly recommended him to the youthful gentry. With the old, he had another part to play, which, when needful, he could sustain with great decorum. His knowledge of books, however superficial, was sufficient to impress upon their ignorance respect for his supposed learning, and the gravity of his deportment and language, with the high tone which he exerted in setting forth the authority of the church and of the priesthood, impressed them no less with an opinion of his sanctity. Even the common people, the severest critics of the conduct of their betters, had commiseration with the follies of Prior Aymer. He was generous, and charity, as it is well known, covereth a multitude of sins, in another sense than that in which it is said to do so in Scripture. The revenues of the monastery, of which a large part was at his disposal, while they gave him the means of supplying his own very considerable expenses, afforded also those largesses which he bestowed among the peasantry, and with which he frequently relieved the distresses of the oppressed. If Prior Aymer rode hard in the chase, or remained long at the banquet, if Prior Aymer was seen, at the early peep of dawn, to enter the postern of the abbey, as he glided home from some rendezvous which had occupied the hours of darkness, men only shrugged up their shoulders, and reconciled themselves to his irregularities, by recollecting that the same were practiced by many of his brethren who had no redeeming qualities whatsoever to atone for them. Prior Aymer, therefore, and his character, were well known to our Saxon serfs, who made their rude obeisance, and received his benedicite, mes felts, in return. But the singular appearance of his companion and his attendants, arrested their attention and excited their wonder, and they could scarcely attend to the prior of Jorvalk's question, when he demanded if they knew of any place of harborage in the vicinity, so much were they surprised at the half-monastic, half-military appearance of the swarthy stranger, and at the uncouth dress and arms of his eastern attendants. It is probable, too, that the language in which the benediction was conferred, and the information asked, sounded ungracious, though not probably unintelligible, in the ears of the Saxon peasants. I asked you, my children, said the prior, raising his voice, and using the lingua franca, or mixed language, in which the Norman and Saxon races conversed with each other, if there be in this neighborhood any good man, who, for the love of God, and devotion to Mother Church, will give two of her humblest servants, with their train, a night's hospitality and refreshment. This he spoke with a tone of conscious importance, which formed a strong contrast to the modest terms which he thought it proper to employ. Two of the humblest servants of Mother Church, repeated Wamba to himself, but, fool as he was, taking care not to make his observation audible, I should like to see her seneschals, her chief butlers, and other principal domestics." After this internal commentary on the prior's speech, he raised his eyes, and replied to the question which had been put. "If the reverend fathers," he said, "loved good cheer and soft lodging, few miles of riding would carry them to the Priory of Brinksworth, where their quality could not but secure them the most honorable reception, or if they preferred spending a penitential evening, they might turn down yonder wild glade, which would bring them to the hermitage of Copmanhurst, where a pious anchoret would make them sharers for the night of the shelter of his roof and the benefit of his prayers." The prior shook his head at both proposals. "Mine honest friend," said he, "if the jangling of thy bells had not dizzied thine understanding, thou mightst know clericus clericum non decimat, that is to say, we churchmen do not exhaust each other's hospitality, but rather require that of the laity, giving them thus an opportunity to serve God in honoring and relieving his appointed servants." "It is true," replied Wamba, "that I, being but an ass, am, nevertheless, honored to hear the bells as well as your reverence's mule. Notwithstanding, I did conceive that the charity of Mother Church and her servants might be said, with other charity, to begin at home." "A truce to thine insolence, fellow," said the armed rider, breaking in on his prattle with a high and stern voice, "and tell us, if thou canst, the road to how called you your Franklin, Prior Aymer?"
"Cedric," answered the prior, "Cedric the Saxon. Tell me, good fellow, are we near his dwelling, and can you show us the road?"
"The road will be uneasy to find," answered Gurth, who broke silence for the first time, "and the family of Cedric retire early to rest."
"Dush, tell not me, fellow," said the military rider, "'tis easy for them to arise and supply the wants of travelers such as we are, who will not stoop to beg the hospitality which we have a right to command."
"I know not," said Gurth, sullenly, "if I should show the way to my master's house, to those who demand as a right, the shelter which most are fain to ask as a favor."
"Do you dispute with me, slave?" said the soldier, and, setting spurs to his horse, he caused him make a demi-volt across the path, raising at the same time the riding rod which he held in his hand, with the purpose of chastising what he considered as the insolence of the peasant. Gurth darted at him a savage and revengeful scowl, and with a fierce, yet hesitating motion, laid his hand on the haft of his knife, but the interference of Prior Aymer, who pushed his mule betwixt his companion and the swineherd, prevented the meditated violence.
"Nay, by St. Mary, Brother Brian, you must not think you are now in Palestine, predominating over heathen Turks and infidel Saracens. We islanders love not blows, save those of Holy Church, who chasteneth whom she loveth. Tell me, good fellow," said he to Wamba, and seconded his speech by a small piece of silver coin, "the way to Cedric the Saxons, you cannot be ignorant of it, and it is your duty to direct the wanderer even when his character is less sanctified than ours."
"In truth, venerable father," answered the jester, "the Saracen head of your right reverend companion has frightened out of mine the way home. I am not sure I shall get there tonight myself."
"Dush," said the abbot, "thou canst tell us if thou wilt. This reverend brother has been all his life engaged in fighting among the Saracens for the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre. He is of the order of Knights Templars, whom you may have heard of. He is half a monk, half a soldier."
"If he is but half a monk," said the jester, "he should not be wholly unreasonable with those whom he meets upon the road, even if they should be in no hurry to answer questions that no way concern them."
"I forgive thy wit," replied the abbot, "on condition thou wilt show me the way to Cedric's mansion."
"Well, then," answered Wamba, "your reverences must hold on this path till you come to a sunken cross, of which scarce a cubit's length remains above ground. Then take the path to the left, for there are four which meet at Sunken Cross, and I trust your reverences will obtain shelter before the storm comes on."
The abbot thanked his sage adviser, and the cavalcade, setting spurs to their horses, rode on as men do who wish to reach their inn before the bursting of a night storm. As their horses' hoofs died away, Gurth said to his companion, "If they follow thy wise direction, the reverend fathers will hardly reach Rotherwood this night."
"No," said the jester, grinning, "but they may reach Sheffield if they have good luck, and that is as fit a place for them. I am not so bad a woodsman as to show the dog where the deer lies, if I have no mind he should chase him."
"Thou art right," said Gurth, "it were ill that Aymer saw the Lady Rowena, and it were worse, it may be, for Cedric to quarrel, as is most likely he would, with this military monk. But, like good servants, let us hear and see, and say nothing." We return to the riders, who had soon left the bondsmen far behind them, and who maintained the following conversation in the Norman French language, usually employed by the superior classes, with the exception of the few who were still inclined to boast their Saxon descent. "What mean these fellows by their capricious insolence?
said the Templar to the Benedictine, and why did you prevent me from chastising it?
Mary, Brother Brian, replied the prior, touching the one of them, it were hard for me to render a reason for a fool speaking according to his folly, and the other churl is of that savage, fierce, intractable race, some of whom, as I have often told you, are still to be found among the descendants of the conquered Saxons, and whose supreme pleasure it is to testify, by all means in their power, their aversion to their conquerors.
I would soon have beat him into courtesy, observed Brian, I am accustomed to deal with such spirits, our Turkish captives are as fierce and intractable as Odin himself could have been, yet 2 months in my household, under the management of my master of the slaves, has made them humble, submissive, serviceable, and observant of your will.
Mary, sir, you must be aware of the poison and the dagger, for they use either with free will when you give them the slightest opportunity.
Ay, but, answered Prior Aymer, every land has its own manners and fashions, and, besides that beating this fellow could procure us no information respecting the road to Cedric's house, it would have been sure to have established a quarrel betwixt you and him had we found our way thither. Remember what I told you, this wealthy Franklin is proud, fierce, jealous, and irritable, a withstander of the nobility, and even of his neighbors, Reginald Front de Boeuf and Philip Malvoisin, who are no babies to strive with. He stands up sternly for the privileges of his race, and is so proud of his uninterrupted descent from Hereward, a renowned champion of the Heptarchy, that he is universally called Cedric the Saxon, and makes a boast of his belonging to a people from whom many others endeavor to hide their descent, lest they should encounter a share of the Valvictus, or severities imposed upon the vanquished.
Prior Aymer, said the Templar, you are a man of gallantry, learned in the study of beauty, and as expert as a troubadour in all matters concerning the arts of love, but I shall expect much beauty in this celebrated Rowena to counterbalance the self-denial and forbearance which I must exert if I am to court the favor of such a seditious churl as you have described her father Cedric.
Cedric is not her father, replied the prior, and is but of remote relation, she is descended from higher blood than even he pretends to, and is but distantly connected with him by birth. Her guardian, however, he is, self-constituted as I believe, but his ward is as dear to him as if she were his own child. Of her beauty you shall soon be judge, and if the purity of her complexion, and the majestic, yet soft expression of a mild blue eye, do not chase from your memory the black-tressed girls of Palestine, eh, or the houris of old Mahoon's paradise, I am an infidel, and no true son of the church.
Should your boasted beauty, said the Templar, be weighed in the balance and found wanting, you know our wager?
My gold collar, answered the prior, against 10 butts of kine wine, they are mine as securely as if they were already in the convent vaults, under the key of old Dennis the cellarer.
And I am myself to be judge, said the Templar, and am only to be convicted on my own admission, that I have seen no maiden so beautiful since Pentecost was a twelvemonth.
Ran it not so?
Prior, your collar is in danger, I will wear it over my gorget in the lists of Ashby de la Zouche.
Win it fairly, said the prior, and wear it as ye will. I will trust your giving true response, on your word as a knight and as a churchman. Yet, brother, take my advice, and file your tongue to a little more courtesy than your habits of predominating over infidel captives and eastern bondsmen have accustomed you. Cedric the Saxon, if offended, and he is no way slack in taking offense, is a man who, without respect to your knighthood, my high office, or the sanctity of either, would clear his house of us, and send us to lodge with the larks, though the hour were midnight. And be careful how you look on Rowena, whom he cherishes with the most jealous care, and he take the least alarm in that quarter we are but lost men. It is said he banished his only son from his family for lifting his eyes in the way of affection towards this beauty, who may be worshipped, it seems, at a distance, but is not to be approached with other thoughts than such as we bring to the shrine of the Blessed Virgin.
Well, you have said enough, answered the Templar, I will for a night put on the needful restraint, and deport me as meekly as a maiden. But as for the fear of his expelling us by violence, myself and squires, with Hamid and Abdallah, will warrant you against that disgrace. Doubt not that we shall be strong enough to make good our quarters.
We must not let it come so far, answered the prior, but here is the clown's sunken cross, and the night is so dark that we can hardly see which of the roads we are to follow. He bid us turn, I think, to the left.
To the right, said Brian, to the best of my remembrance.
To the left, certainly, the left. I remember his pointing with his wooden sword.
Ay, but he held his sword in his left hand, and so pointed across his body with it, said the Templar.
Each maintained his opinion with sufficient obstinacy, as is usual in all such cases, the attendants were appealed to, but they had not been near enough to hear Wamba's directions. At length Brian remarked, What had at first escaped him in the twilight, here is someone either asleep, or lying dead at the foot of this cross. Hugo, stir him with the butt end of thy lance. This was no sooner done than the figure arose, exclaiming in good French, Whosoever thou art, it is discourteous in you to disturb my thoughts. We did but wish to ask you, said the prior, the road to Rotherwood, the abode of Cedric the Saxon. I myself am bound thither, replied the stranger, and if I had a horse, I would be your guide, for the way is somewhat intricate, though perfectly well known to me. Thou shalt have both thanks and reward, my friend, said the prior, if thou wilt bring us to Cedric's in safety. And he caused one of his attendants to mount his own led horse, and give it upon which he had hitherto ridden to the stranger, who was to serve for a guide. Their conductor pursued an opposite road from that which Wamba had recommended, for the purpose of misleading them. The path soon led deeper into the woodland, and crossed more than one brook, the approach to which was rendered perilous by the marshes through which it flowed, but the stranger seemed to know, as if by instinct, the soundest ground and the safest points of passage, and by dint of caution and attention, brought the party safely into a wilder avenue than any they had yet seen, and, pointing to a large low irregular building at the upper extremity, he said to the prior, Yonder is Rotherwood, the dwelling of Cedric the Saxon. This was a joyful intimation to Aymer, whose nerves were none of the strongest, and who had suffered such agitation and alarm in the course of passing through the dangerous bogs, that he had not yet had the curiosity to ask his guide a single question. Finding himself now at his ease and near shelter, his curiosity began to awake, and he demanded of the guide who and what he was. A palmer, just returned from the Holy Land, was the answer. You had better have tarried there to fight for the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre, said the Templar. True, Reverend Sir Knight, answered the palmer, to whom the appearance of the Templar seemed perfectly familiar, but when those who are under oath to recover the Holy City, are found traveling at such a distance from the scene of their duties, can you wonder that a peaceful peasant like me should decline the task which they have abandoned? The Templar would have made an angry reply, but was interrupted by the prior, who again expressed his astonishment, that their guide, after such long absence, should be so perfectly acquainted with the passes of the forest. I was born a native of these parts, answered their guide, and as he made the reply they stood before the mansion of Cedric, a low irregular building, containing several courtyards or enclosures, extending over a considerable space of ground, and which, though its size argued the inhabitant to be a person of wealth, differed entirely from the tall, turreted, and castellated buildings in which the Norman nobility resided, and which had become the universal style of architecture throughout England. Rotherwood was not, however, without defences. No habitation, in that disturbed period, could have been so, without the risk of being plundered and burnt before the next morning. A deep fosse, or ditch, was drawn around the whole building, and filled with water from a neighboring stream. A double stockade, or palisade, composed of pointed beams, which the adjacent forest supplied, defended the outer and inner bank of the trench. There was an entrance from the west through the outer stockade, which communicated by a drawbridge, with a similar opening in the interior defenses. Some precautions had been taken to place those entrances under the protection of projecting angles, by which they might be flanked in case of need by archers or slingers. Before this entrance the Templar wound his horn loudly, for the rain, which had long threatened, began now to descend with great violence. Chapter 3. Then, said Relief, from the bleak coast that hears the German ocean roar, deep blooming, strong, and yellow-haired, the blue-eyed Saxon came. Thomson's Liberty. In a hall, the height of which was greatly disproportioned to its extreme length and width, a long oaken table, formed of planks rough-hewn from the forest, and which had scarcely received any polish, stood ready prepared for the evening meal of Cedric the Saxon. The roof, composed of beams and rafters, had nothing to divide the apartment from the sky excepting the planking and thatch. There was a huge fireplace at either end of the hall, but as the chimneys were constructed in a very clumsy manner, at least as much of the smoke found its way into the apartment as escaped by the proper vent. The constant vapor which this occasioned, had polished the rafters and beams of the low-browed hall, by encrusting them with a black varnish of soot. On the sides of the apartment hung implements of war and of the chase, and there were at each corner folding doors, which gave access to other parts of the extensive building. The other appointments of the mansion partook of the rude simplicity of the Saxon period, which Cedric piqued himself upon maintaining. The floor was composed of earth mixed with lime, trodden into a hard substance, such as is often employed in flooring our modern barns. For about one quarter of the length of the apartment, the floor was raised by a step, and this space, which was called the dais, was occupied only by the principal members of the family, and visitors of distinction.
For this purpose, a table richly covered with scarlet cloth was placed transversely across the platform, from the middle of which ran the longer and lower board, at which the domestics and inferior persons fed, down towards the bottom of the hall. The whole resembled the form of the letter T, or some of those ancient dinner tables, which, arranged on the same principles, may be still seen in the antique colleges of Oxford or Cambridge. Massive chairs and settles of carved oak were placed upon the dais, and over these seats and the more elevated table was fastened a canopy of cloth, which served in some degree to protect the dignitaries who occupied that distinguished station from the weather, and especially from the rain, which in some places found its way through the ill-constructed roof. The walls of this upper end of the hall, as far as the dais extended, were covered with hangings or curtains, and upon the floor there was a carpet, both of which were adorned with some attempts at tapestry, or embroidery, executed with brilliant or rather gaudy coloring. Over the lower range of table, the roof, as we have noticed, had no covering, the rough plastered walls were left bare, and the rude earthen floor was uncarpeted, the board was uncovered by a cloth, and rude massive benches supplied the place of chairs. In the center of the upper table, were placed two chairs more elevated than the rest, for the master and mistress of the family, who presided over the scene of hospitality, and from doing so derived their Saxon title of honor, which signifies the dividers of bread. To each of these chairs was added a footstool, curiously carved and inlaid with ivory, which mark of distinction was peculiar to them. One of these seats was at present occupied by Cedric the Saxon, who, though but in rank a thane, or, as the Normans called him, a franklin, felt, at the delay of his evening meal, an irritable impatience, which might have become an alderman, whether of ancient or of modern times. It appeared, indeed, from the countenance of this proprietor, that he was of a frank, but hasty and choleric temper. He was not above the middle stature, but broad-shouldered, long-armed, and powerfully made, like one accustomed to endure the fatigue of war or of the chase. His face was broad, with large blue eyes, open and frank features, fine teeth, and a well-formed head, altogether expressive of that sort of good humor which often lodges with a sudden and hasty temper. Pride and jealousy there was in his eye, for his life had been spent in asserting rights which were constantly liable to invasion, and the prompt, fiery, and resolute disposition of the man, had been kept constantly upon the alert by the circumstances of his situation. His long yellow hair was equally divided on the top of his head and upon his brow, and combed down on each side to the length of his shoulders. It had but little tendency to gray, although Cedric was approaching to his 60th year. His dress was a tunic of forest green, furred at the throat and cuffed with what was called menever, a kind of fur inferior in quality to ermine, and formed, it is believed, of the skin of the gray squirrel. This doublet hung unbuttoned over a close dress of scarlet which sat tight to his body. He had breeches of the same, but they did not reach below the lower part of the thigh, leaving the knee exposed. His feet had sandals of the same fashion with the peasants, but of finer materials, and secured in the front with golden clasps. He had bracelets of gold upon his arms, and a broad collar of the same precious metal around his neck. About his waist he wore a richly studded belt, in which was stuck a short straight two-edged sword, with a sharp point, so disposed as to hang almost perpendicularly by his side. Behind his seat was hung a scarlet cloth cloak lined with fur, and a cap of the same materials richly embroidered, which completed the dress of the opulent landholder when he chose to go forth. A short boar spear, with a broad and bright steel head, also reclined against the back of his chair, which served him, when he walked abroad, for the purposes of a staff or of a weapon, as chance might require. Several domestics, whose dress held various proportions betwixt the richness of their masters, and the coarse and simple attire of Gurth the swineherd, watched the looks and waited the commands of the Saxon dignitary. Two or three servants of a superior order stood behind their master upon the dais, the rest occupied the lower part of the hall. Other attendants there were of a different description, two or three large and shaggy greyhounds, such as were then employed in hunting the stag and wolf, as many slow hounds of a large bony breed, with thick necks, large heads, and long ears, and one or two of the smaller dogs, now called terriers, which waited with impatience the arrival of the supper, but, with the sagacious knowledge of physiognomy peculiar to their race, forbore to intrude upon the moody silence of their master, apprehensive probably of a small white truncheon which lay by Cedric's trencher, for the purpose of repelling the advances of his four-legged dependents. One grisly old wolf dog alone, with the liberty of an indulged favorite, had planted himself close by the chair of state, and occasionally ventured to solicit notice by putting his large hairy head upon his master's knee, or pushing his nose into his hand. Even he was repelled by the stern command, "Down, Balder, down. I am not in the humor for foolery." In fact, Cedric,
as we have observed, was in no very placid state of mind. The Lady Rowena, who had been absent to attend an evening mass at a distant church, had but just returned, and was changing her garments, which had been wetted by the storm. There were as yet no tidings of Gurth and his charge, which should long since have been driven home from the forest, and such was the insecurity of the period, as to render it probable that the delay might be explained by some depreciation of the outlaws, with whom the adjacent forest abounded, or by the violence of some neighboring baron, whose consciousness of strength made him equally negligent of the laws of property. The matter was of consequence, for great part of the domestic wealth of the Saxon proprietors consisted in numerous herds of swine, especially in forest land, where those animals easily found their food. Besides these subjects of anxiety, the Saxon thane was impatient for the presence of his favorite clown Wamba, whose jests, such as they were, served for a sort of seasoning to his evening meal, and to the deep draughts of ale and wine with which he was in the habit of accompanying it. Add to all this, Cedric had fasted since noon, and his usual supper hour was long past, a cause of irritation common to country squires, both in ancient and modern times. His displeasure was expressed in broken sentences, partly muttered to himself, partly addressed to the domestics who stood around, and particularly to his cupbearer, who offered him from time to time, as a sedative, a silver goblet filled with wine. "Why tarries the Lady Rowena?" "She is but changing her headgear," replied a female attendant, with as much confidence as the favorite lady's maid usually answers the master of a modern family. "You would not wish her to sit down to the banquet in her hood and kirtle? And no lady within the shire can be quicker in arraying herself than my mistress." This undeniable argument produced a sort of acquiescent oomph on the part of the Saxon, with the addition, "I wish her devotion may choose fair weather for the next visit to St. John's Kirk." "But what, in the name of 10 devils, continued he, turning to the cupbearer, and raising his voice as if happy to have found a channel into which he might divert his indignation without fear or control, "what, in the name of 10 devils, keeps Gurth so long afield? I suppose we shall have an evil account of the herd. He was wont to be a faithful and cautious drudge, and I had destined him for something better. Perchance I might even have made him one of my warders." 11. Oswald the cupbearer modestly suggested that it was scarce an hour since the tolling of the curfew, an ill-chosen apology, since it turned upon a topic so harsh to Saxon ears. "The foul fiend," exclaimed Cedric, "take the curfew bell, and the tyrannical bastard by whom it was devised, and the heartless slave who names it with a Saxon tongue to a Saxon ear. The curfew," he added, pausing, "the curfew, which compels true men to extinguish their lights, that thieves and robbers may work their deeds in darkness. The curfew, Reginald Front de Boeuf and Philip de Malvoise and know the use of the curfew as well as William the Bastard himself, or e'er a Norman adventurer that fought at Hastings. I shall hear, I guess, that my property has been swept off to save from starving the hungry banditti, whom they cannot support but by theft and robbery. My faithful slave is murdered, and my goods are taken for a prey in Wamba." "Where is Wamba?" said not someone he had gone forth with Gurth? Oswald replied in the affirmative. "Eh? Why, this is better and better. He is carried off too, the Saxon fool, to serve the Norman lord. Fools are we all indeed that serve them, and fitter subjects for their scorn and laughter, than if we were born with but half our wits. But I will be avenged," he added, starting from his chair in impatience at the supposed injury, and catching hold of his boar spear, "I will go with my complaint to the great council. I have friends, I have followers, man to man will I appeal the Norman to the lists. Let him come in his plate and his mail, and all that can render cowardice bold. I have sent such a javelin as this through a stronger fence than 3 of their war shields. Haply they think me old, but they shall find, alone and childless as I am, the blood of Hereward is in the veins of Cedric. Ah, Wilfred, Wilfred," he exclaimed in a lower tone, "couldst thou have ruled thine unreasonable passion, thy father had not been left in his age like the solitary oak that throws out its shattered and unprotected branches against the full sweep of the tempest." The reflection seemed to conjure into sadness his irritated feelings. Replacing his javelin, he resumed his seat, bent his looks downward, and appeared to be absorbed in melancholy reflection. From his musing, Cedric was suddenly awakened by the blast of a horn, which was replied to by the clamorous yells and barking of all the dogs in the hall, and some 20 or 30 which were quartered in other parts of the building. It cost some exercise of the white truncheon, well seconded by the exertions of the domestics, to silence this canine clamor. "To the gate, knaves," said the Saxon, hastily, as soon as the tumult was so much appeased that the dependents could hear his voice. "See what tidings that horn tells us of to announce, I ween, some hership, 12, and robbery which has been done upon my lands. Returning in less than 3 minutes, a warder announced that the Prior-Aimer of Jorvalks, and the good knight Brian de Bois Guilbert, commander of the valiant and venerable Order of Knights Templars, with a small retinue, requested hospitality and lodging for the night, being on their way to a tournament which was to be held not far from Ashby de la Zouche, on the second day from the present. "Aimer, the Prior-Aimer? Brian de Bois Guilbert?" muttered Cedric. "Normans both, but Norman or Saxon, the hospitality of Rotherwood must not be impeached. They are welcome, since they have chosen to halt. More welcome would they have been to have ridden further on their way, but it were unworthy to murmur for a night's lodging and a night's food. In the quality of guests, at least, even Normans must suppress their insolence. Go, Hundibert," he added, to a sort of majordomo who stood behind him with a white wand, "take 6 of the attendants, and introduce the strangers to the guests' lodging. Look after their horses and mules, and see their train lack nothing. Let them have change of vestments if they require it, and fire, and water to wash, and wine and ale, and bid the cooks add what they hastily can to our evening meal, and let it be put on the board when those strangers are ready to share it. Say to them, Hundibert, that Cedric would himself bid them welcome, but he is under a vow never to step more than 3 steps from the dais of his own hall to meet any who shares not the blood of Saxon royalty. Begone. See them carefully tended, let them not say in their pride, the Saxon churl has shown at once his poverty and his avarice." The majordomo departed with several attendants, to execute his master's commands. "The Prior-Aimer," repeated Cedric, looking to Oswald, "the brother, if I mistake not, of Giles de Maleverer, now Lord of Middleham?" Oswald made a respectful sign of assent. "His brother sits in the seat, and usurps the patrimony, of a better race, the race of Ulfgar of Middleham, but what Norman lord doth not the same? This prior is, they say, a free and jovial priest, who loves the wine cup and the bugle horn better than bell and book. Good, let him come, he shall be welcome. How named ye the Templar?"
"Brian de Bois Guilbert."
"Bois Guilbert," said Cedric, still in the musing, half-arguing tone, which the habit of living among dependents had accustomed him to employ, and which resembled a man who talks to himself rather than to those around him. "Bois Guilbert. That name has been spread wide both for good and evil. They say he is valiant as the bravest of his order, but stained with their usual vices, pride, arrogance, cruelty, and voluptuousness, a hard-hearted man, who knows neither fear of earth, nor awe of heaven. So say the few warriors who have returned from Palestine. Well, it is but for one night, he shall be welcome too. Oswald, broach the oldest wine cask, place the best mead, the mightiest ale, the richest morat, the most sparkling cider, the most odoriferous pigments, upon the board, fill the largest horns, 13, Templars and abbots love good wines and good measure. Elgitha, let thy lady Rowena know we shall not this night expect her in the hall, unless such be her especial pleasure." "But it will be her especial pleasure," answered Elgitha, with great readiness, for she is ever desirous to hear the latest news from Palestine. Cedric darted at the forward damsel a glance of hasty resentment, but Rowena, and whatever belonged to her, were privileged and secure from his anger. He only replied, "Silence, maiden, thy tongue outruns thy discretion. Say my message to thy mistress, and let her do her pleasure. Here, at least, the descendant of Alfred still reigns a princess." Elgitha left the apartment.
"Palestine," repeated the Saxon, "Palestine. How many ears are turned to the tales which dissolute crusaders, or hypocritical pilgrims, bring from that fatal land? I too might ask, I too might inquire, I too might listen with a beating heart to fables which the wily strollers devise to cheat us into hospitality, but know the son who has disobeyed me is no longer mine, nor will I concern myself more for his fate than for that of the most worthless among the millions that ever shaped the cross on their shoulder, rushed into excess and blood guiltiness, and called it an accomplishment of the will of God." He knit his brows, and fixed his eyes for an instant on the ground. As he raised them, the folding doors at the bottom of the hall were cast wide, and, preceded by the majordomo with his wand, and 4 domestics bearing blazing torches, the guests of the evening entered the apartment.
Chapter 4. With sheep and shaggy goats the porkers bled, and the proud steer was on the marble spread, with fire prepared, they deal the morsels round, wine rosy bright the brimming goblets crowned. Disposed apart, Ulysses shares the treat, a trivet table and ignobler seat, the prince assigns, Odyssey, Book 21. The Prior-Aimer had taken the opportunity afforded him, of changing his riding robe for one of yet more costly materials, over which he wore a cope curiously embroidered. Besides the massive golden signet ring, which marked his ecclesiastical dignity, his fingers, though contrary to the canon, were loaded with precious gems, his sandals were of the finest leather which was imported from Spain, his beard trimmed to as small dimensions as his order would possibly permit, and his shaven crown concealed by a scarlet cap richly embroidered. The appearance of the Knight Templar was also changed, and, though less studiously bedecked with ornament, his dress was as rich, and his appearance far more commanding, than that of his companion. He had exchanged his shirt of mail for an under tunic of dark purple silk, garnished with furs, over which flowed his long robe of spotless white, in ample folds. The eight-pointed cross of his order was cut on the shoulder of his mantle in black velvet. The high cap no longer invested his brows, which were only shaded by short and thick curled hair of a raven blackness, corresponding to his unusually swart complexion. Nothing could be more gracefully majestic than his step and manner, had they not been marked by a predominant air of haughtiness, easily acquired by the exercise of unresisted authority. These two dignified persons were followed by their respective attendants, and at a more humble distance by their guide, whose figure had nothing more remarkable than it derived from the usual weeds of a pilgrim. A cloak or mantle of coarse black serge enveloped his whole body. It was in shape something like the cloak of a modern hussar, having similar flaps for covering the arms, and was called a sclaven, or sclavonian. Coarse sandals, bound with thongs, on his bare feet, a broad and shadowy hat, with cockle shells stitched on its brim, and a long staff shod with iron, to the upper end of which was attached a branch of palm, completed the palmer's attire. He followed modestly the last of the train which entered the hall, and, observing that the lower table scarce afforded room sufficient for the domestics of Cedric and the retinue of his guests, he withdrew to a settle placed beside and almost under one of the large chimneys, and seemed to employ himself in drying his garments, until the retreat of someone should make room at the board, or the hospitality of the steward should supply him with refreshments in the place he had chosen apart. Cedric rose to receive his guests with an air of dignified hospitality, and, descending from the dais, or elevated part of his hall, made three steps towards them, and then awaited their approach. "I grieve," he said, "reverend prior, that my vow binds me to advance no farther upon this floor of my father's, even to receive such guests as you, and this valiant knight of the Holy Temple. But my steward has expounded to you the cause of my seeming discourtesy. Let me also pray, that you will excuse my speaking to you in my native language, and that you will reply in the same if your knowledge of it permits. If not, I sufficiently understand Norman to follow your meaning." "Vows," said the abbot, "must be unloosed, worthy Franklin, or permit me rather to say, worthy Thane, though the title is antiquated. Vows are the knots which tie us to heaven, they are the cords which bind the sacrifice to the horns of the altar, and are therefore, as I said before, to be unloosened and discharged, unless our Holy Mother Church shall pronounce the contrary. And respecting language, I willingly hold communication in that spoken by my respected grandmother, Hilda of Middleham, who died in odor of sanctity, little short, if we may presume to say so, of her glorious namesake, the blessed Saint Hilda of Whitby, God be gracious to her soul." When the prior had ceased what he meant as a conciliatory harangue, his companion said briefly and emphatically, "I speak ever French, the language of King Richard and his nobles, but I understand English sufficiently to communicate with the natives of the country." Cedric darted at the speaker one of those hasty and impatient glances, which comparisons between the two rival nations seldom fail to call forth, but, recollecting the duties of hospitality, he suppressed further show of resentment, and, motioning with his hand, caused his guests to assume two seats a little lower than his own, but placed close beside him, and gave a signal that the evening meal should be placed upon the board. While the attendants hastened to obey Cedric's commands, his eye distinguished Gurth the swineherd, who, with his companion Wamba, had just entered the hall. "Send these loitering knaves up hither," said the Saxon, impatiently. "And when the culprits came before the dais, how comes it, villains, that you have loitered abroad so late as this? Hast thou brought home thy charge, Sirrah Gurth, or hast thou left them to robbers and marauders?"
"The herd is safe, so please ye," said Gurth.
"But it does not please me, thou knave," said Cedric, "that I should be made to suppose otherwise for 2 hours, and sit here devising vengeance against my neighbors for wrongs they have not done me. I tell thee, shackles and the prison house shall punish the next offense of this kind." Gurth, knowing his master's irritable temper, attempted no exculpation, but the jester, who could presume upon Cedric's tolerance, by virtue of his privileges as a fool, replied for them both, "In troth, Uncle Cedric, you are neither wise nor reasonable tonight."
"How, sir?" said his master. "You shall to the porter's lodge, and taste of the discipline there, if you give your foolery such license."
"First let your wisdom tell me,"
said Wamba, is it just and reasonable to punish one person for the fault of another?
Certainly not, fool, answered Cedric.
Then why should you shackle poor Girth, uncle, for the fault of his dog Fangs? For I dare be sworn we lost not a minute by the way, when we had got our herd together, which Fangs did not manage until we heard the vesper bell.
Then hang up Fangs, said Cedric, turning hastily towards the swineherd, if the fault is his, and get thee another dog.
Under favour, uncle, said the jester, that were still somewhat on the bow hand of fair justice, for it was no fault of Fangs that he was lame and could not gather the herd, but the fault of those that struck off two of his four claws, an operation for which, if the poor fellow had been consulted, he would scarce have given his voice.
And who dared to lame an animal which belonged to my bondsman? Said the Saxon, kindling in wrath.
Marry, that did old Hubert, said Wamba, Sir Philip de Malvoisin's keeper of the chase. He caught Fangs strolling in the forest, and said he chased the deer contrary to his master's right, as warden of the walk.
The foul fiend take Malvoisin, answered the Saxon, and his keeper both. I will teach them that the wood was disforested in terms of the great forest charter. But enough of this. Go to, knave, go to thy place and thou, Girth, get thee another dog, and should the keeper dare to touch it, I will mar his archery, the curse of a coward on my head, if I strike not off the forefinger of his right hand. He shall draw bowstring no more. I crave your pardon, my worthy guests. I am beset here with neighbors that match your infidels, Sir Knight, in Holy Land. But your homely fare is before you, feed, and let welcome make amends for hard fare. The feast, however, which was spread upon the board, needed no apologies from the lord of the mansion. Swine's flesh, dressed in several modes, appeared on the lower part of the board, as also that of fowls, deer, goats, and hares, and various kinds of fish, together with huge loaves and cakes of bread, and sundry confections made of fruits and honey. The smaller sorts of wildfowl, of which there was abundance, were not served up in platters, but brought in upon small wooden spits or brooches, and offered by the pages and domestics who bore them, to each guest in succession, who cut from them such a portion as he pleased. Beside each person of rank was placed a goblet of silver, the lower board was accommodated with large drinking horns. When the repast was about to commence, the major domo, or steward, suddenly raising his wand, said aloud, "Forbear! Place for the Lady Rowena." A side door at the upper end of the hall now opened behind the banquet table, and Rowena, followed by four female attendants, entered the apartment. Cedric, though surprised, and perhaps not altogether agreeably so, at his ward appearing in public on this occasion, hastened to meet her, and to conduct her, with respectful ceremony, to the elevated seat at his own right hand, appropriated to the lady of the mansion. All stood up to receive her, and, replying to their courtesy by a mute gesture of salutation, she moved gracefully forward to assume her place at the board. Ere she had time to do so, the Templar whispered to the prior, "I shall wear no collar of gold of yours at the tournament. The Cayenne wine is your own." "Said I not so?" answered the prior, "but check your raptures, the Franklin observes you."
Unheeding this remonstrance, and accustomed only to act upon the immediate impulse of his own wishes, Brian de Bois Guilbert kept his eyes riveted on the Saxon beauty, more striking perhaps to his imagination, because differing widely from those of the Eastern Sultanas. Formed in the best proportions of her sex, Rowena was tall in stature, yet not so much so as to attract observation on account of superior height. Her complexion was exquisitely fair, but the noble cast of her head and features prevented the insipidity which sometimes attaches to fair beauties. Her clear blue eye, which sat enshrined beneath a graceful eyebrow of brown sufficiently marked to give expression to the forehead, seemed capable to kindle as well as melt, to command as well as to beseech. If mildness were the more natural expression of such a combination of features, it was plain that in the present instance, the exercise of habitual superiority, and the reception of general homage, had given to the Saxon lady a loftier character, which mingled with and qualified that bestowed by nature. Her profuse hair, of a color betwixt brown and flaxen, was arranged in a fanciful and graceful manner in numerous ringlets, to form which art had probably aided nature. These locks were braided with gems, and, being worn at full length, intimated the noble birth and freeborn condition of the maiden. A golden chain, to which was attached a small reliquary of the same metal, hung round her neck. She wore bracelets on her arms, which were bare. Her dress was an undergown and kirtle of pale sea-green silk, over which hung a long loose robe, which reached to the ground, having very wide sleeves, which came down, however, very little below the elbow. This robe was crimson, and manufactured out of the very finest wool. A veil of silk, interwoven with gold,
was attached to the upper part of it, which could be, at the wearer's pleasure, either drawn over the face and bosom after the Spanish fashion, or disposed as a sort of drapery round the shoulders. When Rowena perceived the Knight Templar's eyes bent on her with an ardor, that, compared with the dark caverns under which they moved, gave them the effect of lighted charcoal, she drew with dignity the veil around her face, as an intimation that the determined freedom of his glance was disagreeable. Cedric saw the motion and its cause. "Sir Templar," said he, "the cheeks of our Saxon maidens have seen too little of the sun to enable them to bear the fixed glance of a crusader." "If I have offended," replied Sir Brian, "I crave your pardon, that is, I crave the Lady Rowena's pardon, for my humility will carry me no lower." "The Lady Rowena," said the prior, "has punished us all, in chastising the boldness of my friend. Let me hope she will be less cruel to the splendid train which are to meet at the tournament." "Our going thither," said Cedric, "is uncertain. I love not these vanities, which were unknown to my fathers when England was free." "Let us hope, nevertheless," said the prior, "our company may determine you to travel thitherward, when the roads are so unsafe. The escort of Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert is not to be despised." "Sir Prior," answered the Saxon, "wheresoever I have travelled in this land, I have hitherto found myself, with the assistance of my good sword and faithful followers, in no respect needful of other aid. At present, if we indeed journey to Ashby de la Zouche, we do so with my noble neighbour and countryman Athelstane of Coningsborough, and with such a train as would set outlaws and feudal enemies at defiance. I drink to you, Sir Prior, in this cup of wine, which I trust your taste will approve, and I thank you for your courtesy. Should you be so rigid in adhering to monastic rule," he added, "as to prefer your acid preparation of milk, I hope you will not strain courtesy to do me reason." "Nay," said the priest, laughing, "it is only in our abbey that we confine ourselves to the lac dulce or the lac acidum either. Conversing with the world, we use the world's fashions, and therefore I answer your pledge in this honest wine, and leave a weaker liquor to my lay brother." "And I," said the Templar, filling his goblet, "drink wassail to the fair Rowena, for since her namesake introduced the word into England, has never been one more worthy of such a tribute. By my faith, I could pardon the unhappy Vortigern, had he half the cause that we now witness, for making shipwreck of his honour and his kingdom." "I will spare your courtesy, Sir Knight," said Rowena with dignity, and without unveiling herself, "or rather I will tax it so far as to require of you the latest news from Palestine, a theme more agreeable to our English ears than the compliments which your French breeding teaches." "I have little of importance to say, lady," answered Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert, "excepting the confirmed tidings of a truce with Saladin." He was interrupted by Wamba, who had taken his appropriated seat upon a chair, the back of which was decorated with two ass's ears, and which was placed about two steps behind that of his master, who, from time to time, supplied him with victuals from his own trencher, a favor, however, which the jester shared with the favorite dogs, of whom, as we have already noticed, there were several in attendance. Here sat Wamba, with a small table before him, his heels tucked up against the bar of the chair, his cheeks sucked up so as to make his jaws resemble a pair of nutcrackers, and his eyes half shut, yet watching with alertness every opportunity to exercise his licensed foolery. "These truces with the infidels," he exclaimed, without caring how suddenly he interrupted the stately Templar, "make an old man of me." "Go to, knave, how so?" said Cedric, his features prepared to receive favorably the expected jest. "Because," answered Wamba, "I remember three of them in my day, each of which was to endure for the course of 50 years, so that, by computation, I must be at least 150 years old." "I will warrant you against dying of old age, however," said the Templar, who now recognized his friend of the forest, "I will assure you from all deaths but a violent one, if you give such directions to wayfarers, as you did this night to the prior and me." "How, sirrah?" said Cedric, "misdirect travellers? We must have you whipped, you are at least as much rogue as fool." "I pray thee, uncle," answered the jester, "let my folly, for once, protect my roguery. I did but make a mistake between my right hand and my left, and he might have pardoned a greater, who took a fool for his counsellor and guide." Conversation was here interrupted by the entrance of the porter's page, who announced that there was a stranger at the gate, imploring admittance and hospitality. "Admit him," said Cedric, "be he who or what he may, a knight like that which roars without, compels even wild animals to herd with tame, and to seek the protection of man, their mortal foe, rather than perish by the elements. Let his wants be ministered to with all care, look to it, Oswald." And the steward left the banqueting hall to see the commands of his patron obeyed. Chapter 5.
Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer, as a Christian is? Merchant of Venice. Oswald, returning, whispered into the ear of his master, "It is a Jew, who calls himself Isaac of York. Is it fit I should marshal him into the hall?" "Let earth do thine office, Oswald," said Wamba with his usual effrontery, "the swineherd will be a fit usher to the Jew." "Saint Mary," said the abbot, crossing himself, "an unbelieving Jew, and admitted into this presence." "A dog Jew," echoed the Templar, "to approach a defender of the Holy Sepulchre?" "By my faith," said Wamba, "it would seem the Templars love the Jews' inheritance better than they do their company." "Peace, my worthy guests," said Cedric, "my hospitality must not be bounded by your dislikes. If heaven bore with the whole nation of stiff-necked unbelievers for more years than a layman can number, we may endure the presence of one Jew for a few hours. But I constrain no man to converse or to feed with him. Let him have a board and a morsel apart, unless," he said smiling, "these turbaned strangers will admit his society." "Sir Franklin," answered the Templar, "my Saracen slaves are true Muslims, and scorn as much as any Christian to hold intercourse with a Jew." "Now, in faith," said Wamba, "I cannot see that the worshippers of Mahound and Termagant have so greatly the advantage over the people once chosen of heaven." "He shall sit with thee, Wamba," said Cedric, "the fool and the knave will be well met." "The fool," answered Wamba, raising the relics of a gammon of bacon, "will take care to erect a bulwark against the knave." "Hush," said Cedric, "for here he comes." Introduced with little ceremony, and advancing with fear and hesitation, and many a bow of deep humility, a tall thin old man, who, however, had lost by the habit of stooping much of his actual height, approached the lower end of the board. His features, keen and regular, with an aquiline nose, and piercing black eyes, his high and wrinkled forehead, and long grey hair and beard, would have been considered as handsome, had they not been the marks of a physiognomy peculiar to a race, which, during those dark ages, was alike detested by the credulous and prejudiced vulgar, and persecuted by the greedy and rapacious nobility, and who, perhaps, owing to that very hatred and persecution, had adopted a national character, in which there was much, to say the least, mean and unamiable. The Jew's dress, which appeared to have suffered considerably from the storm, was a plain russet cloak of many folds, covering a dark purple tunic. He had large boots lined with fur, and a belt around his waist, which sustained a small knife, together with a case for writing materials, but no weapon. He wore a high square yellow cap of a peculiar fashion, a sign to his nation to distinguish them from Christians, and which he doffed with great humility at the door of the hall. The reception of this person in the hall of Cedric the Saxon was such as might have satisfied the most prejudiced enemy of the tribes of Israel. Cedric himself coldly nodded in answer to the Jew's repeated salutations, and signed to him to take place at the lower end of the table, where, however, no one offered to make room for him. On the contrary, as he passed along the file, casting a timid supplicating glance, and turning towards each of those who occupied the lower end of the board, the Saxon domestics squared their shoulders, and continued to devour their supper with great perseverance, paying not the least attention to the wants of the new guest. The attendants of the abbot crossed themselves, with looks of pious horror, and the very heathen Saracens, as Isaac drew near them, curled up their whiskers with indignation, and laid their hands on their poniards, as if ready to rid themselves by the most desperate means from the apprehended contamination of his nearer approach. Probably the same motives which induced Cedric to open his hall to this son of a rejected people, would have made him insist on his attendants receiving Isaac with more courtesy. But the abbot had, at this moment, engaged him in a most interesting discussion on the breed and character of his favorite hounds, which he would not have interrupted for matters of much greater importance than that of a Jew going to bed supperless. While Isaac thus stood an outcast in the present society, like his people among the nations, looking in vain for welcome or resting place, the pilgrim who sat by the chimney took compassion upon him, and resigned his seat, saying briefly, "Old man, my garments are dried, my hunger is appeased, thou art both wet and fasting." So saying, he gathered together, and brought to a flame, the decaying brands which lay scattered on the ample hearth, took from the larger board a mess of pottage and seethed kid, placed it upon the small table at which he had himself supped, and, without waiting the Jew's thanks, went to the other side of the hall, whether from unwillingness to hold more close communication with the object of his benevolence, or from a wish to draw near to the upper end of the table, seemed uncertain. Had there been painters in those days capable to execute such a subject, the Jew,
as he bent his withered form, and expanded his chilled and trembling hands over the fire, would have formed no bad emblematical personification of the winter season. Having dispelled the cold, he turned eagerly to the smoking mess which was placed before him, and ate with a haste and an apparent relish, that seemed to betoken long abstinence from food. Meanwhile the abbot and Cedric continued their discourse upon hunting. The Lady Rowena seemed engaged in conversation with one of her attendant females, and the haughty Templar, whose eye wandered from the Jew to the Saxon beauty, revolved in his mind thoughts which appeared deeply to interest him. "I marvel, worthy Cedric," said the abbot, as their discourse proceeded, "that, great as your predilection is for your own manly language, you do not receive the Norman French into your favor, so far at least as the mystery of woodcraft and hunting is concerned. Surely no tongue is so rich in the various phrases which the field sports demand, or furnishes means to the experienced woodman so well to express his jovial art." "Good Father Aymer," said the Saxon, "be it known to you, I care not for those oversea refinements, without which I can well enough take my pleasure in the woods. I can wind my horn, though I call not the blessed either a recreate or a mort. I can cheer my dogs on the prey, and I can flay and quarter the animal when it is brought down, without using the newfangled jargon of curé, arbor, nombles, and all the babble of the fabulous Sir Tristram." 14. "The French," said the Templar, raising his voice with the presumptuous and authoritative tone which he used upon all occasions, "is not only the natural language of the chase, but that of love and of war, in which ladies should be won and enemies defied." "Pledge me in a cup of wine, Sir Templar," said Cedric, "and fill another to the abbot, while I look back some 30 years to tell you another tale." As Cedric the Saxon then was, his plain English tale needed no garnish from French troubadours, when it was told in the Year of Beauty, and the field of Northallerton, upon the day of the Holy Standard, could tell whether the Saxon war cry was not heard as far within the ranks of the Scottish host as the Creta Gare of the boldest Norman baron. "To the memory of the brave who fought there. Pledge me, my guests." He drank deep, and went on with increasing warmth. "Ay, that was a day of cleaving of shields, when 100 banners were bent forwards over the heads of the valiant, and blood flowed round like water, and death was held better than flight. A Saxon bard had called it a feast of the swords, a gathering of the eagles to the prey, the clashing of bills upon shield and helmet, the shouting of battle more joyful than the clamor of a bridle. But our bards are no more," he said, "our deeds are lost in those of another race, our language, our very name is hastening to decay, and none mourns for it save one solitary old man cupbearer. Knave, fill the goblets to the strong in arms, Sir Templar, be their race or language what it will, who now bear them best in Palestine among the champions of the cross." "It becomes not one wearing this badge to answer," said Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert, "yet to whom, besides the sworn champions of the Holy Sepulchre, can the palm be assigned among the champions of the cross?" "To the Knights Hospitallers," said the abbot, "I have a brother of their order." "I impeach not their fame," said the Templar, "nevertheless. I think, friend Cedric," said Wamba, interfering, "that had Richard of the Lion's Heart been wise enough to have taken a fool's advice, he might have stayed at home with his merry Englishmen, and left the recovery of Jerusalem to those same knights who had most to do with the loss of it." "Were there, then, none in the English army," said the Lady Rowena, "whose names are worthy to be mentioned with the Knights of the Temple, and of St. John?" "Forgive me, lady," replied de Bois Guilbert, "the English monarch did, indeed, bring to Palestine a host of gallant warriors, second only to those whose breasts have been the unceasing bulwark of that blessed land." "Second to none," said the pilgrim, who had stood near enough to hear, and had listened to this conversation with marked impatience. All turned toward the spot from whence this unexpected asseveration was heard. "I say," repeated the pilgrim in a firm and strong voice, "that the English chivalry were second to none who ever drew sword in defense of the Holy Land. I say besides, for I saw it, that King Richard himself, and 5 of his knights, held a tournament after the taking of St. John de Acre, as challengers against all comers. I say that, on that day, each knight ran 3 courses, and cast to the ground 3 antagonists. I add, that 7 of these assailants were knights of the Temple, and Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert well knows the truth of what I tell you." It is impossible for language to describe the bitter scowl of rage which rendered yet darker the swarthy countenance of the Templar. In the extremity of his resentment and confusion, his quivering fingers griped towards the handle of his sword, and perhaps only withdrew, from the consciousness that no act of violence could be safely executed in that place and presence. Cedric, whose feelings were all of a right onward and simple kind, and were seldom occupied by more than one object at once, omitted, in the joyous glee with which he heard of the glory of his countrymen, to remark the angry confusion of his guest,
I would give thee this golden bracelet, pilgrim, he said, couldst thou tell me the names of those knights who upheld so gallantly the renown of Merry England?
That will I do blithely, replied the pilgrim, and without guerdon. My oath, for a time, prohibits me from touching gold.
I will wear the bracelet for you, if you will, friend Palmer, said Wamba.
The first in honor as in arms, in renown as in place, said the pilgrim, was the brave Richard, King of England.
I forgive him, said Cedric, I forgive him his descent from the tyrant Duke William.
The Earl of Leicester was the second, continued the pilgrim, Sir Thomas Multon of Gilsland was the third.
Of Saxon descent, he at least, said Cedric, with exultation.
Sir Fulk d'Oily the fourth, proceeded the pilgrim.
Saxon also, at least by the mother's side, continued Cedric, who listened with the utmost eagerness, and forgot, in part at least, his hatred to the Normans, in the common triumph of the King of England and his islanders.
And who was the fifth? He demanded.
The fifth was Sir Edwin Turnham.
Genuine Saxon, by the soul of Hengist, shouted Cedric, and the sixth?
He continued with eagerness, how name you the sixth?
The sixth, said the palmer, after a pause, in which he seemed to recollect himself, was a young knight of lesser renown and lower rank, assumed into that honorable company, less to aid their enterprise than to make up their number. His name dwells not in my memory.
Sir Palmer, said Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert scornfully, this assumed forgetfulness, after so much has been remembered, comes too late to serve your purpose. I will myself tell the name of the knight before whose lance fortune and my horse's fault occasioned my falling. It was the knight of Ivanhoe, nor was there one of the six that, for his years, had more renown in arms. Yet this will I say, and loudly, that were he in England, and durst repeat, in this week's tournament, the challenge of St. John de Acre, I, mounted and armed as I now am, would give him every advantage of weapons, and abide the result.
Your challenge would soon be answered, replied the palmer, were your antagonist near you.
As the matter is, disturb not the peaceful hall with vaunts of the issue of the conflict, which you well know cannot take place. If Ivanhoe ever returns from Palestine, I will be his surety that he meets you.
A goodly security, said the Knight Templar, and what do you proffer as a pledge?
This reliquary, said the palmer, taking a small ivory box from his bosom, and crossing himself, containing a portion of the true cross, brought from the monastery of Mount Carmel.
The prior of Jorvaulx crossed himself and repeated a Pater Noster, in which all devoutly joined, excepting the Jew, the Mohammedans, and the Templar, the latter of whom, without veiling his bonnet, or testifying any reverence for the alleged sanctity of the relic, took from his neck a gold chain, which he flung on the board, saying, let Prior Aymer hold my pledge and that of this nameless vagrant, in token that when the knight of Ivanhoe comes within the four seas of Britain, he underlies the challenge of Brian de Bois Guilbert, which, if he answer not, I will proclaim him as a coward on the walls of every temple court in Europe.
It will not need, said the Lady Rowena, breaking silence, my voice shall be heard, if no other in this hall is raised in behalf of the absent Ivanhoe. I affirm he will meet fairly every honorable challenge. Could my weak warrant add security to the inestimable pledge of this holy pilgrim, I would pledge name and fame that Ivanhoe gives this proud knight the meeting he desires.
A crowd of conflicting emotions seemed to have occupied Cedric, and kept him silent during this discussion. Gratified pride, resentment, embarrassment, chased each other over his broad and open brow, like the shadow of clouds drifting over a harvest field, while his attendants, on whom the name of the sixth knight seemed to produce an effect almost electrical, hung in suspense upon their master's looks. But when Rowena spoke, the sound of her voice seemed to startle him from his silence.
Lady, said Cedric, this beseems not, were further pledge necessary, I myself, offended, and justly offended, as I am, would yet gage my honor for the honor of Ivanhoe. But the wager of battle is complete, even according to the fantastic fashions of Norman chivalry, is it not, Father Aymer?
It is, replied the prior, and the blessed relic and rich chain will I bestow safely in the treasury of our convent, until the decision of this warlike challenge.
Having thus spoken, he crossed himself again and again, and after many genuflections and muttered prayers, he delivered the reliquary to Brother Ambrose, his attendant monk, while he himself swept up with less ceremony, but perhaps with no less internal satisfaction, the golden chain, and bestowed it in a pouch lined with perfumed leather, which opened under his arm.
And now, Sir Cedric, he said, my ears are chiming vespers with the strength of your good wine. Permit us another pledge to the welfare of the Lady Rowena, and indulge us with liberty to pass to our repose.
By the rood of Brom, said the Saxon, you do but small credit to your fame, Sir Prior.
Report speaks you a bonny monk, that would hear the matine chime ere he quitted his bowl, and, old as I am, I feared to have shame in encountering you. But, by my faith, a Saxon boy of 12, in my time, would not so soon have relinquished his goblet. The prior had his own reasons, however, for persevering in the course of temperance which he had adopted. He was not only a professional peacemaker, but from practice a hater of all feuds and brawls. It was not altogether from a love to his neighbor, or to himself, or from a mixture of both. On the present occasion, he had an instinctive apprehension of the fiery temper of the Saxon, and saw the danger that the reckless and presumptuous spirit, of which his companion had already given so many proofs, might at length produce some disagreeable explosion. He therefore gently insinuated the incapacity of the native of any other country to engage in the genial conflict of the bull with the hardy and strong-headed Saxons, something he mentioned, but slightly, about his own holy character, and ended by pressing his proposal to depart to repose. The grace cup was accordingly served round, and the guests, after making deep obeisance to their landlord and to the Lady Rowena, arose and mingled in the hall, while the heads of the family, by separate doors, retired with their attendants. "Unbelieving dog," said the Templar to Isaac the Jew, as he passed him in the throng, "dost thou bend thy course to the tournament?"
"I do so propose," replied Isaac, bowing in all humility, "if it please your reverend valor."
"Ay," said the knight, "to gnaw the bowels of our nobles with usury, and to gall women and boys with gods and toys, I warrant thee store of shekels in thy Jewish scrip."
"Not a shekel, not a silver penny, not a halfling, so help me the God of Abraham," said the Jew, clasping his hands,
"I go but to seek the assistance of some brethren of my tribe to aid me to pay the fine which the exchequer of the Jews have imposed upon me. Father Jacob be my speed. I am an impoverished wretch, the very gabardine I wear is borrowed from Reuben of Tadcaster."
15.
The Templar smiled sourly as he replied, "Beshrew thee for a false-hearted liar." And passing onward, as if disdaining farther conference, he communed with his Muslim slaves in a language unknown to the bystanders. The poor Israelite seemed so staggered by the address of the military monk, that the Templar had passed on to the extremity of the hall ere he raised his head from the humble posture which he had assumed, so far as to be sensible of his departure. And when he did look around, it was with the astonished air of one at whose feet a thunderbolt has just burst, and who hears still the astounding report ringing in his ears. The Templar and Prior were shortly after marshalled to their sleeping apartments by the steward and the cupbearer, each attended by two torchbearers and two servants carrying refreshments, while servants of inferior condition indicated to their retinue and to the other guests their respective places of repose.
Chapter 6.
"To buy his favor I extend this friendship, if he will take it. So, if not, adieu, and, for my love, I pray you wrong me not." Merchant of Venice. As the palmer, lighted by a domestic with a torch, passed through the intricate combination of apartments of this large and irregular mansion, the cupbearer coming behind him whispered in his ear, that if he had no objection to a cup of good mead in his apartment, there were many domestics in that family who would gladly hear the news he had brought from the Holy Land, and particularly that which concerned the Knight of Ivanhoe. Wamba presently appeared to urge the same request, observing that a cup after midnight was worth three after curfew. Without disputing a maxim urged by such grave authority, the palmer thanked them for their courtesy, but observed that he had included in his religious vow an obligation never to speak in the kitchen on matters which were prohibited in the hall. "That vow," said Wamba to the cupbearer, "would scarce suit a serving man." The cupbearer shrugged up his shoulders in displeasure. "I thought to have lodged him in the solier chamber," said he, "but since he is so unsocial to Christians, e'en let him take the next stall to Isaac the Jews." "Anwold," said he to the torchbearer, "carry the pilgrim to the southern cell. I give you good night," he added, "Sir Palmer, with small thanks for short courtesy."
"Good night, and Our Lady's benison," said the palmer, with composure, and his guide moved forward. In a small antechamber, into which several doors opened, and which was lighted by a small iron lamp, they met a second interruption from the waiting maid of Rowena, who, saying in a tone of authority, that her mistress desired to speak with the palmer, took the torch from the hand of Anwold, and, bidding him await her return, made a sign to the palmer to follow. Apparently he did not think it proper to decline this invitation as he had done the former, for, though his gesture indicated some surprise at the summons, he obeyed it without answer or remonstrance. A short passage, and in a set of seven steps, each of which was composed of a solid beam of oak, led into the apartment of the Lady Rowena, the rude magnificence of which corresponded to the respect which was paid to her by the lord of the mansion. The walls were covered with embroidered hangings, on which different colored silks, interwoven with gold and silver threads,
had been employed with all the art of which the age was capable, to represent the sports of hunting and hawking. The bed was adorned with the same rich tapestry, and surrounded with curtains dyed with purple. The seats had also their stained coverings, and one, which was higher than the rest, was accommodated with a footstool of ivory, curiously carved. No fewer than 4 silver candelabras, holding great waxen torches, served to illuminate this apartment. Yet let not modern beauty envy the magnificence of a Saxon princess. The walls of the apartment were so ill-finished and so full of crevices, that the rich hanging shook in the night blast, and, in despite of a sort of screen intended to protect them from the wind, the flame of the torches streamed sideways into the air, like the unfurled pennant of a chieftain. Magnificence there was, with some rude attempt at taste, but of comfort there was little, and, being unknown, it was unmissed. The Lady Rowena, with 3 of her attendants standing at her back, and arranging her hair ere she lay down to rest, was seated in the sort of throne already mentioned, and looked as if born to exact general homage. The pilgrim acknowledged her claim to it by a low genuflection. "Rise, Palmer," said she graciously. "The defender of the absent has a right to favorable reception from all who value truth, and honor manhood." She then said to her train, "Retire, excepting only Elgitha, I would speak with this holy pilgrim." The maidens, without leaving the apartment, retired to its further extremity, and sat down on a small bench against the wall, where they remained mute as statues, though at such a distance that their whispers could not have interrupted the conversation of their mistress. "Pilgrim," said the lady, after a moment's pause, during which she seemed uncertain how to address him, "you this night mentioned a name." "I mean," she said, with a degree of effort, "the name of Ivanhoe, in the halls where by nature and kindred it should have sounded most acceptably, and yet, such is the perverse course of fate, that of many whose hearts must have throbbed at the sound, I, only, dare ask you where, and in what condition, you left him of whom you spoke? We heard, that, having remained in Palestine, on account of his impaired health, after the departure of the English army, he had experienced the persecution of the French faction, to whom the Templars are known to be attached." "I know little of the Knight of Ivanhoe," answered the palmer, with a troubled voice. "I would I knew him better, since you, lady, are interested in his fate. He hath, I believe, surmounted the persecution of his enemies in Palestine, and is on the eve of returning to England, where you, lady, must know better than I, what is his chance of happiness." The Lady Rowena sighed deeply, and asked more particularly when the Knight of Ivanhoe might be expected in his native country, and whether he would not be exposed to great dangers by the road. On the first point, the palmer professed ignorance; on the second, he said that the voyage might be safely made by the way of Venice and Genoa, and from thence through France to England. Ivanhoe, he said, was so well acquainted with the language and manners of the French, that there was no fear of his incurring any hazard during that part of his travels. "Would to God," said the Lady Rowena, "he were here safely arrived, and able to bear arms in the approaching journey, in which the chivalry of this land are expected to display their address and valor. Should Athelstane of Coningsborough obtain the prize, Ivanhoe is like to hear evil tidings when he reaches England. How looked he, stranger, when you last saw him? Had disease laid her hand heavy upon his strength and comeliness?" "He was darker," said the palmer, "and thinner, than when he came from Cyprus in the train of Coeur de Lion, and care seemed to sit heavy on his brow, but I approached not his presence, because he is unknown to me." "He will," said the lady, "I fear, find little in his native land to clear those clouds from his countenance. Thanks, good pilgrim, for your information concerning the companion of my childhood. Maidens," she said, "draw near, offer the sleeping cup to this holy man, whom I will no longer detain from repose." One of the maidens presented a silver cup, containing a rich mixture of wine and spice, which Rowena barely put to her lips. It was then offered to the palmer, who, after a low obeisance, tasted a few drops. "Accept this alms, friend," continued the lady, offering a piece of gold, "in acknowledgement of thy painful travail, and of the shrines thou hast visited." The palmer received the boon with another low reverence, and followed Edwina out of the apartment. In the anteroom he found his attendant Hanwold, who, taking the torch from the hand of the waiting maid, conducted him with more haste than ceremony to an exterior and ignoble part of the building, where a number of small apartments, or rather cells, served for sleeping places to the lower order of domestics, and to strangers of mean degree. "In which of these sleeps the Jew?" said the pilgrim. "The unbelieving dog," answered Anwold, "kennels in the cell next your holiness. St. Dunstan, how it must be scraped and cleansed ere it be again fit for a Christian."
"And where sleeps Girth the swineherd?" said the stranger.
"Girth," replied the bondsman, "sleeps in the cell on your right,
As the Jew on that to your left, you serve to keep the child of circumcision separate from the abomination of his tribe. You might have occupied a more honorable place had you accepted of Oswald's invitation.
It is as well as it is, said the palmer, the company, even of a Jew, can hardly spread contamination through an oaken partition. So saying, he entered the cabin allotted to him, and taking the torch from the domestic's hand, thanked him, and wished him good night. Having shut the door of his cell, he placed the torch in a candlestick made of wood, and looked around his sleeping apartment, the furniture of which was of the most simple kind. It consisted of a rude wooden stool, and still ruder hutch or bed frame, stuffed with clean straw, and accommodated with two or three sheepskins by way of bedclothes. The palmer, having extinguished his torch, threw himself, without taking off any part of his clothes, on this rude couch, and slept, or at least retained his recumbent posture, till the earliest sunbeams found their way through the little grated window, which served at once to admit both air and light to his uncomfortable cell. He then started up, and after repeating his matins, and adjusting his dress, he left it, and entered that of Isaac the Jew, lifting the latch as gently as he could. The inmate was lying in troubled slumber upon a couch similar to that on which the palmer himself had passed the night. Such parts of his dress as the Jew had laid aside on the preceding evening, were disposed carefully around his person, as if to prevent the hazard of their being carried off during his slumbers. There was a trouble on his brow amounting almost to agony. His hands and arms moved convulsively, as if struggling with a nightmare, and besides several ejaculations in Hebrew, the following were distinctly heard in the Norman English, or mixed language of the country: "For the sake of the God of Abraham, spare an unhappy old man. I am poor, I am penniless. Should your irons wrench my limbs asunder, I could not gratify you." The palmer awaited not the end of the Jew's vision, but stirred him with his pilgrim's staff. The touch probably associated, as is usual, with some of the apprehensions excited by his dream, for the old man started up, his gray hair standing almost erect upon his head, and huddling some part of his garments about him, while he held the detached pieces with the tenacious grasp of a falcon, he fixed upon the palmer his keen black eyes, expressive of wild surprise and of bodily apprehension. "Fear nothing from me, Isaac," said the palmer, "I come as your friend." "The God of Israel requite you," said the Jew, greatly relieved, "I dreamed, but Father Abraham be praised, it was but a dream." Then, collecting himself, he added in his usual tone, "And what may it be your pleasure to want at so early an hour with a poor Jew?" "It is to tell you," said the palmer, "that if you leave not this mansion instantly, and travel not with some haste, your journey may prove a dangerous one." "Holy Father," said the Jew, "whom could it interest to endanger so poor a wretch as I am?" "The purpose you can best guess," said the pilgrim, "but rely on this, that when the Templar crossed the hall yesternight, he spoke to his Mussulman slaves in the Saracen language, which I well understand, and charged them this morning to watch the journey of the Jew, to seize upon him when at a convenient distance from the mansion, and to conduct him to the castle of Philip de Malvoisin, or to that of Reginald Front de Boeuf." It is impossible to describe the extremity of terror which seized upon the Jew at this information, and seemed at once to overpower his whole faculties. His arms fell down to his sides, and his head drooped on his breast, his knees bent under his weight, every nerve and muscle of his frame seemed to collapse and lose its energy, and he sunk at the foot of the palmer, not in the fashion of one who intentionally stoops, kneels, or prostrates himself to excite compassion, but like a man borne down on all sides by the pressure of some invisible force, which crushes him to the earth without the power of resistance. "Holy God of Abraham!" was his first exclamation, folding and elevating his wrinkled hands, but without raising his gray head from the pavement. "Oh, holy Moses! Oh, blessed Aaron! The dream is not dreamed for naught, and the vision cometh not in vain. I feel their irons already tear my sinews. I feel the rack pass over my body like the saws, and harrows, and axes of iron over the men of Rabbah, and of the cities of the children of Ammon." "Stand up, Isaac, and hearken to me," said the palmer, who viewed the extremity of his distress with a compassion in which contempt was largely mingled. "You have cause for your terror, considering how your brethren have been used, in order to extort from them their hoards, both by princes and nobles, but stand up, I say, and I will point out to you the means of escape. Leave this mansion instantly, while its inmates sleep sound after the last night's revel. I will guide you by the secret paths of the forest, known as well to me as to any forester that ranges it, and I will not leave you till you are under safe conduct of some chief or baron going to the tournament, whose goodwill you have probably the means of securing." As the ears of Isaac received the hopes of escape which this speech intimated, he began gradually, and inch by inch, as it were, to raise himself up from the ground,
until he fairly rested upon his knees, throwing back his long gray hair and beard, and fixing his keen black eyes upon the palmer's face, with a look expressive at once of hope and fear, not unmingled with suspicion. But when he heard the concluding part of the sentence, his original terror appeared to revive in full force, and he dropped once more on his face, exclaiming, "I possess the means of securing goodwill. Alas! There is but one road to the favor of a Christian, and how can the poor Jew find it, whom extortions have already reduced to the misery of Lazarus?" Then, as if suspicion had overpowered his other feelings, he suddenly exclaimed, "For the love of God, young man, betray me not for the sake of the great Father who made us all, Jew as well as Gentile, Israelite and Ishmaelite, do me no treason. I have not means to secure the goodwill of a Christian beggar, were he rating it at a single penny." As he spoke these last words, he raised himself, and grasped the palmer's mantle with a look of the most earnest entreaty. The pilgrim extricated himself, as if there were contamination in the touch. "Wert thou loaded with all the wealth of thy tribe," he said, "what interest have I to injure thee? In this dress I am vowed to poverty, nor do I change it for aught save a horse and a coat of mail. Yet think not that I care for thy company, or propose myself advantage by it. Remain here if thou wilt, Cedric the Saxon may protect thee." "Alas," said the Jew, "he will not let me travel in his train. Saxon or Norman will be equally ashamed of the poor Israelite, and to travel by myself through the domains of Philip de Malvoisin and Reginald Front de Boeuf, good youth, I will go with you. Let us haste, let us gird up our loins, let us flee. Here is thy staff, why wilt thou tarry?"
"I tarry not," said the pilgrim, giving way to the urgency of his companion, "but I must secure the means of leaving this place, follow me." He led the way to the adjoining cell, which, as the reader is apprised, was occupied by Gurth the swineherd.
"Arise, Gurth," said the pilgrim, "arise quickly. Undo the postern gate, and let out the Jew and me." Gurth, whose occupation, though now held so mean, gave him as much consequence in Saxon England as that of Eumaeus in Ithaca, was offended at the familiar and commanding tone assumed by the palmer. "The Jew leaving Rotherwood," said he, raising himself on his elbow, and looking superciliously at him without quitting his pallet, "and travelling in company with the palmer to boot."
"I should as soon have dreamt," said Wamba, who entered the apartment at the instant, "of his stealing away with a gammon of bacon."
"Nevertheless," said Gurth, again laying down his head on the wooden log which served him for a pillow, "both Jew and Gentile must be content to abide the opening of the great gate. We suffer no visitors to depart by stealth at these unseasonable hours."
"Nevertheless," said the pilgrim, in a commanding tone, "you will not, I think, refuse me that favor."
So saying, he stooped over the bed of the recumbent swineherd, and whispered something in his ear in Saxon. Gurth started up as if electrified. The pilgrim, raising his finger in an attitude as if to express caution, added, "Gurth, beware, thou art wont to be prudent. I say, undo the postern, thou shalt no more anon." With hasty alacrity Gurth obeyed him, while Wamba and the Jew followed, both wondering at the sudden change in the swineherd's demeanor.
"My mule, my mule," said the Jew, as soon as they stood without the postern.
"Fetch him his mule," said the pilgrim, "and, hearest thou, let me have another, that I may bear him company till he is beyond these parts. I will return it safely to some of Cedric's train at Ashby. And do thou," he whispered the rest in Gurth's ear.
"Willingly, most willingly shall it be done," said Gurth, and instantly departed to execute the commission.
"I wish I knew," said Wamba, when his comrade's back was turned, "what you palmers learn in the Holy Land."
"To say our orisons, fool," answered the pilgrim, "to repent our sins, and to mortify ourselves with fastings, vigils, and long prayers."
"Something more potent than that," answered the jester, "for when would repentance or prayer make Gurth do a courtesy, or fasting or vigil persuade him to lend you a mule? I trow you might as well have told his favorite black boar of thy vigils and penance, and wouldst have gotten as civil an answer."
"Go to," said the pilgrim, "thou art but a Saxon fool."
"Thou sayst well," said the jester, "had I been born a Norman, as I think thou art, I would have had luck on my side, and been next door to a wise man."
At this moment Gurth appeared on the opposite side of the moat with the mules. The travellers crossed the ditch upon a drawbridge of only 2 planks breadth, the narrowness of which was matched with the straightness of the postern, and with a little wicket in the exterior palisade, which gave access to the forest. No sooner had they reached the mules, than the Jew, with hasty and trembling hands, secured behind the saddle a small bag of blue buckram, which he took from under his cloak, containing, as he muttered, "a change of raiment, only a change of raiment." Then getting upon the animal with more alacrity and haste than could have been anticipated from his years, he lost no time in so disposing of the skirts of his gabardine as to conceal completely from observation the burden which he had thus deposited en croupe. The pilgrim mounted with more deliberation, reaching, as he departed, his hand to Gurth, who kissed it with the utmost possible veneration. The swineherd stood gazing after the travellers until they were lost under the boughs of the forest path, when he was disturbed from his reverie by the voice of Wamba. "Knowest thou," said the jester, "my good friend Gurth, that thou art strangely courteous and most unwontedly pious on this summer morning? I would I were a black prior or a barefoot palmer, to avail myself of thy unwonted zeal and courtesy certes, I would make more out of it than a kiss of the hand." "Thou art no fool thus far, Wamba," answered Gurth, "though thou arguest from appearances, and the wisest of us can do no more, but it is time to look after my charge." So saying, he turned back to the mansion, attended by the jester. Meanwhile the travellers continued to press on their journey with a dispatch which argued the extremity of the Jew's fears, since persons at his age are seldom fond of rapid motion. The palmer, to whom every path and outlet in the wood appeared to be familiar, led the way through the most devious paths, and more than once excited anew the suspicion of the Israelite, that he intended to betray him into some ambuscade of his enemies. His doubts might have been indeed pardoned, for, except perhaps the flying fish, there was no race existing on the earth, in the air, or the waters, who were the object of such an unintermitting, general, and relentless persecution as the Jews of this period. Upon the slightest and most unreasonable pretenses, as well as upon accusations the most absurd and groundless, their persons and property were exposed to every turn of popular fury, for Norman, Saxon, Dane, and Briton, however adverse these races were to each other, contended which should look with greatest detestation upon a people, whom it was accounted a point of religion to hate, to revile, to despise, to plunder, and to persecute. The kings of the Norman race, and the independent nobles, who followed their example in all acts of tyranny, maintained against this devoted people a persecution of a more regular, calculated, and self-interested kind. It is a well-known story of King John, that he confined a wealthy Jew in one of the royal castles, and daily caused one of his teeth to be torn out, until, when the jaw of the unhappy Israelite was half disfurnished, he consented to pay a large sum, which it was the tyrant's object to extort from him. The little ready money which was in the country was chiefly in possession of this persecuted people, and the nobility hesitated not to follow the example of their sovereign, in wringing it from them by every species of oppression, and even personal torture. Yet the passive courage inspired by the love of gain, induced the Jews to dare the various evils to which they were subjected, in consideration of the immense profits which they were enabled to realize in a country naturally so wealthy as England. In spite of every kind of discouragement, and even of the special court of taxations already mentioned, called the Jews' Exchequer, erected for the very purpose of despoiling and distressing them, the Jews increased, multiplied, and accumulated huge sums, which they transferred from one hand to another by means of bills of exchange and invention for which commerce is said to be indebted to them, and which enabled them to transfer their wealth from land to land, that when threatened with oppression in one country, their treasure might be secured in another. The obstinacy and avarice of the Jews being thus in a measure placed in opposition to the fanaticism that tyranny of those under whom they lived, seemed to increase in proportion to the persecution with which they were visited, and the immense wealth they usually acquired in commerce, while it frequently placed them in danger, was at other times used to extend their influence, and to secure to them a certain degree of protection. On these terms they lived, and their character, influenced accordingly, was watchful, suspicious, and timid yet obstinate, uncomplying, and skillful in evading the dangers to which they were exposed. When the travellers had pushed on at a rapid rate through many devious paths, the palmer at length broke silence. "That large decayed oak," he said, "marks the boundaries over which Front de Boeuf claims authority. We are long since far from those of Malvoisin. There is now no fear of pursuit." "May the wheels of their chariots be taken off," said the Jew, "like those of the host of Pharaoh, that they may drive heavily. But leave me not, good pilgrim, think but of that fierce and savage Templar, with his Saracen slaves they will regard neither territory, nor manor, nor lordship." "Our road," said the palmer, "should here separate, for it beseems not men of my character and thine to travel together longer than needs must be. Besides, what succor couldst thou have from me, a peaceful pilgrim, against two armed heathens?" "O good youth," answered the Jew, "thou canst defend me, and I know thou wouldst. Poor as I am, I will requite it not with money, for money, so help me my father Abraham, I have none but
money and recompense," said the palmer, interrupting him, "I have already said I require not of thee.
guide thee I can, and, it may be, even in some sort defend thee, since to protect a Jew against a Saracen, can scarce be accounted unworthy of a Christian. Therefore, Jew, I will see thee safe under some fitting escort. We are now not far from the town of Sheffield, where thou mayest easily find many of thy tribe with whom to take refuge. The blessing of Jacob be upon thee, good youth, said the Jew. In Sheffield I can harbour with my kinsman Zareth, and find some means of travelling forth with safety. Be it so, said the palmer, at Sheffield then we part, and half an hour's riding will bring us in sight of that town. The half hour was spent in perfect silence on both parts, the pilgrim perhaps disdaining to address the Jew, except in case of absolute necessity, and the Jew not presuming to force a conversation with a person whose journey to the Holy Sepulchre gave a sort of sanctity to his character. They paused on the top of a gently rising bank, and the pilgrim, pointing to the town of Sheffield, which lay beneath them, repeated the words, "Here, then, we part." "Not till you have had the poor Jew's thanks," said Isaac, "for I presume not to ask you to go with me to my kinsman Zareth's, who might aid me with some means of repaying your good offices." "I have already said," answered the pilgrim, "that I desire no recompense. If among the huge list of thy debtors, thou wilt, for my sake, spare the gyves in the dungeon to some unhappy Christian who stands in thy danger, I shall hold this morning's service to thee well bestowed." "Stay, stay," said the Jew, laying hold of his garment, "something would I do more than this, something for thyself. God knows the Jew is poor, yes, Isaac is the beggar of his tribe, but forgive me should I guess what thou most lackest at this moment." "If thou wert to guess truly," said the palmer, "it is what thou canst not supply. Wert thou as wealthy as thou sayst thou art poor?"
"As I say?" echoed the Jew, "oh! Believe it, I say but the truth, I am a plundered, indebted, distressed man. Hard hands have wrung from me my goods, my money, my ships, and all that I possessed, yet I can tell thee what thou lackest, and, it may be, supply it too. Thy wish even now is for a horse and armor." The palmer started, and turned suddenly towards the Jew. "What fiend prompted that guess?" said he, hastily. "No matter," said the Jew, smiling, "so that it be a true one, and, as I can guess thy want, so I can supply it." "But consider," said the palmer, "my character, my dress, my vow." "I know you Christians," replied the Jew, "and that the noblest of you will take the staff and sandal in superstitious penance, and walk afoot to visit the graves of dead men."
"Blaspheme not, Jew," said the pilgrim, sternly.
"Forgive me," said the Jew, "I spoke rashly. But there dropped words from you last night and this morning, that, like sparks from flint, showed the metal within, and in the bosom of that palmer's gown, is hidden a knight's chain and spurs of gold. They glanced as you stooped over my bed in the morning." The pilgrim could not forbear smiling. "Were thy garments searched by as curious an eye, Isaac," said he, "what discoveries might not be made?"
"No more of that," said the Jew, changing color, and drawing forth his writing materials in haste, as if to stop the conversation. He began to write upon a piece of paper which he supported on the top of his yellow cap, without dismounting from his mule. When he had finished, he delivered the scroll, which was in the Hebrew character, to the pilgrim, saying, "In the town of Leicester all men know the rich Jew, Kerjath Jairam of Lombardy. Give him this scroll, he hath on sale 6 Milan harnesses, the worst would suit a crowned head, 10 goodly steeds, the worst might mount a king, were he to do battle for his throne. Of these he will give thee thy choice, with everything else that can furnish thee forth for the tournament. When it is over, thou wilt return them safely unless thou shouldst have wherewith to pay their value to the owner."
"But, Isaac," said the pilgrim, smiling, "dost thou know that in these sports, the arms and steed of the knight who is unhorsed are forfeit to his victor? Now I may be unfortunate, and so lose what I cannot replace or repay." The Jew looked somewhat astounded at this possibility, but collecting his courage, he replied hastily, "No, no, no, it is impossible, I will not think so. The blessing of our Father will be upon thee. Thy lance will be powerful as the rod of Moses." So saying, he was turning his mule's head away, when the palmer, in his turn, took hold of his gabardine.
"Nay, but Isaac, thou knowest not all the risk. The steed may be slain, the armor injured, for I will spare neither horse nor man. Besides, those of thy tribe give nothing for nothing, something there must be paid for their use."
The Jew twisted himself in the saddle, like a man in a fit of the colic, but his better feelings predominated over those which were most familiar to him.
"I care not," he said, "I care not, let me go. If there is damage, it will cost you nothing; if there is usage money, Kerjath Jairam will forgive it for the sake of his kinsman Isaac. Fare thee well. Yet hark thee, Good youth, said he, turning about, thrust thyself not too forward into this vain hurly-burly. I speak not for endangering the steed and coat of armor, but for the sake of thine own life and limbs.
Gramercy for thy caution, said the palmer, again smiling, I will use thy courtesy frankly, and it will go hard with me, but I will requite it.
They parted, and took different roads for the town of Sheffield.
Chapter 7.
Knights, with a long retinue of their squires, in gaudy liveries march and quaint attires, one laced the helm, another held the lance, a third the shining buckler did advance. The courser pawed the ground with restless feet, and snorting foamed and champed the golden bit. The smiths and armorers on palfreys ride, files in their hands, and hammers at their side, and nails for loosened spears, and thongs for shields provide. The yeomen guard the streets in seemly bands, and clowns come crowding on, with cudgels in their hands.
Palamon and Arcite.
The condition of the English nation was at this time sufficiently miserable. King Richard was absent a prisoner, and in the power of the perfidious and cruel Duke of Austria. Even the very place of his captivity was uncertain, and his fate but very imperfectly known to the generality of his subjects, who were, in the meantime, a prey to every species of subaltern oppression. Prince John, in league with Philip of France, Coeur de Lion's mortal enemy, was using every species of influence with the Duke of Austria, to prolong the captivity of his brother Richard, to whom he stood indebted for so many favors. In the meantime, he was strengthening his own faction in the kingdom, of which he proposed to dispute the succession, in case of the king's death, with the legitimate heir, Arthur Duke of Brittany, son of Geoffrey Plantagenet, the elder brother of John. This usurpation, it is well known, he afterwards effected. His own character being light, profligate, and perfidious, John easily attached to his person and faction, not only all who had reason to dread the resentment of Richard for criminal proceedings during his absence, but also the numerous class of lawless resolutes, whom the Crusades had turned back on their country, accomplished in the vices of the East, impoverished in substance, and hardened in character, and who placed their hopes of harvest in civil commotion. To these causes of public distress and apprehension, must be added, the multitude of outlaws, who, driven to despair by the oppression of the feudal nobility, and the severe exercise of the forest laws, banded together in large gangs, and, keeping possession of the forests and the wastes, set at defiance the justice and magistracy of the country. The nobles themselves, each fortified within his own castle, and playing the petty sovereign over his own dominions, were the leaders of bands scarce less lawless and oppressive than those of the avowed depredators. To maintain these retainers, and to support the extravagance and magnificence which their pride induced them to effect, the nobility borrowed sums of money from the Jews at the most usurious interest, which gnawed into their estates like consuming cankers, scarce to be cured unless when circumstances gave them an opportunity of getting free, by exercising upon their creditors some act of unprincipled violence. Under the various burdens imposed by this unhappy state of affairs, the people of England suffered deeply for the present, and had yet more dreadful cause to fear for the future. To augment their misery, a contagious disorder of a dangerous nature spread through the land, and, rendered more virulent by the uncleanness, the indifferent food, and the wretched lodging of the lower classes, swept off many whose fate the survivors were tempted to envy, as exempting them from the evils which were to come. Yet amid these accumulated distresses, the poor as well as the rich, the vulgar as well as the noble, in the event of a tournament, which was the grand spectacle of that age, felt as much interested as the half-starved citizen of Madrid, who is not a real left to buy provisions for his family, feels in the issue of a bull feast. Neither duty nor infirmity could keep youth or age from such exhibitions. The passage of arms, as it was called, which was to take place at Ashby, in the county of Leicester, as champions of the first renown were to take the field in the presence of Prince John himself, who was expected to grace the lists, had attracted universal attention, and an immense confluence of persons of all ranks hastened upon the appointed morning to the place of combat. The scene was singularly romantic. On the verge of a wood, which approached to within a mile of the town of Ashby, was an extensive meadow, of the finest and most beautiful green turf, surrounded on one side by the forest, and fringed on the other by straggling oak trees, some of which had grown to an immense size. The ground, as if fashioned on purpose for the martial display which was intended, sloped gradually down on all sides to a level bottom, which was enclosed for the lists with strong palisades, forming a space of a quarter of a mile in length, and about half as broad. The form of the enclosure was an oblong square, save that the corners were considerably rounded off, in order to afford more convenience for the spectators. The openings for the entry of the combatants were at the northern and southern extremities of the lists, accessible by strong wooden gates, each wide enough to admit two horsemen riding abreast.
At each of these portals were stationed two heralds, attended by six trumpets, as many pursuivants, and a strong body of men-at-arms for maintaining order, and ascertaining the quality of the knights who proposed to engage in this martial game. On a platform beyond the southern entrance, formed by a natural elevation of the ground, were pitched five magnificent pavilions, adorned with pennons of russet and black, the chosen colors of the five knights challengers. The cords of the tents were of the same color. Before each pavilion was suspended the shield of the knight by whom it was occupied, and beside it stood his squire, quaintly disguised as a salvage or sylvan man, or in some other fantastic dress, according to the taste of his master, and the character he was pleased to assume during the game. 16. The central pavilion, as the place of honor, had been assigned to Brian Dubois Guilbert, whose renown in all games of chivalry, no less than his connections with the knights who had undertaken this passage of arms, had occasioned him to be eagerly received into the company of the challengers, and even adopted as their chief and leader, though he had so recently joined them. On one side of his tent were pitched those of Reginald Front de Boeuf and Richard de Malvoisin, and on the other was the pavilion of Hugh de Grant Mesnil, a noble baron in the vicinity, whose ancestor had been Lord High Steward of England in the time of the Conqueror, and his son William Rufus. Ralph de Vipont, a knight of St. John of Jerusalem, who had some ancient possessions at a place called Heather, near Ashby de la Zouche, occupied the fifth pavilion. From the entrance into the lists, a gently sloping passage, 10 yards in breadth, led up to the platform on which the tents were pitched. It was strongly secured by a palisade on each side, as was the esplanade in front of the pavilions, and the whole was guarded by men-at-arms. The northern access to the lists terminated in a similar entrance of 30 feet in breadth, at the extremity of which was a large enclosed space for such knights as might be disposed to enter the lists with the challengers, behind which were placed tents containing refreshments of every kind for their accommodation, with armorers, terriers, and other attendants, in readiness to give their services wherever they might be necessary. The exterior of the lists was in part occupied by temporary galleries, spread with tapestry and carpets, and accommodated with cushions for the convenience of those ladies and nobles who were expected to attend the tournament. A narrow space, betwixt these galleries and the lists, gave accommodation for yeomanry and spectators of a better degree than the mere vulgar, and might be compared to the pit of a theatre. The promiscuous multitude arranged themselves upon large banks of turf prepared for the purpose, which, aided by the natural elevation of the ground, enabled them to overlook the galleries, and obtain a fair view into the lists. Besides the accommodation which these stations afforded, many hundreds had perched themselves on the branches of the trees which surrounded the meadow, and even the steeple of a country church, at some distance, was crowded with spectators. It only remains to notice respecting the general arrangement, that one gallery in the very center of the eastern side of the lists, and consequently exactly opposite to the spot where the shock of the combat was to take place, was raised higher than the others, more richly decorated, and graced by a sort of throne and canopy, on which the royal arms were emblazoned. Squires, pages, and yeomen in rich liveries, waited around this place of honor, which was designed for Prince John and his attendants. Opposite to this royal gallery was another, elevated to the same height, on the western side of the lists, and more gaily, if less sumptuously decorated, than that destined for the prince himself. A train of pages and of young maidens, the most beautiful who could be selected, gaily dressed in fancy habits of green and pink, surrounded a throne decorated in the same colors. Among pennons and flags bearing wounded hearts, burning hearts, bleeding hearts, bows and quivers, and all the commonplace emblems of the triumphs of Cupid, a blazoned inscription informed the spectators that this seat of honor was designed for La Reine de l'Hospitalité des Amours. But who was to represent the Queen of Beauty and of Love on the present occasion no one was prepared to guess. Meanwhile, spectators of every description thronged forward to occupy their respective stations, and not without many quarrels concerning those which they were entitled to hold. Some of these were settled by the men-at-arms with brief ceremony, the shafts of their battle-axes, and pummels of their swords, being readily employed as arguments to convince the more refractory. Others, which involved the rival claims of more elevated persons, were determined by the heralds, or by the two marshals of the field, William de Wyville, and Stephen de Martivel, who, armed at all points, rode up and down the lists to enforce and preserve good order among the spectators. Gradually the galleries became filled with knights and nobles, in their robes of peace, whose long and rich tinted mantles were contrasted with the gayer and more splendid habits of the ladies, who, in a greater proportion than even the men themselves, thronged to witness a sport, which one would have thought too bloody and dangerous to afford their sex much pleasure. The lower and interior space was soon filled by substantial yeomen and burghers, and such of the lesser gentry, as, from modesty,
poverty, or dubious title, durst not assume any higher place. It was of course amongst these that the most frequent disputes for precedence occurred. "Dog of an unbeliever," said an old man, whose threadbare tunic bore witness to his poverty, as his sword, and dagger, and golden chain intimated his pretensions to rank, "whelp of a she-wolf. Darest thou press upon a Christian, and a Norman gentleman of the blood of Montdidier?" This rough expostulation was addressed to no other than our acquaintance Isaac, who, richly and even magnificently dressed in a gabardine ornamented with lace and lined with fur, was endeavoring to make place in the foremost row beneath the gallery for his daughter, the beautiful Rebecca, who had joined him at Ashby, and who was now hanging on her father's arm, not a little terrified by the popular displeasure which seemed generally excited by her parents' presumption. But Isaac, though we have seen him sufficiently timid on other occasions, knew well that at present he had nothing to fear. It was not in places of general resort, or where their equals were assembled, that any avaricious or malevolent noble durst offer him injury. At such meetings the Jews were under the protection of the general law, and if that proved a weak assurance, it usually happened that there were among the persons assembled some barons, who, for their own interested motives, were ready to act as their protectors. On the present occasion, Isaac felt more than usually confident, being aware that Prince John was even then in the very act of negotiating a large loan from the Jews of York, to be secured upon certain jewels and lands. Isaac's own share in this transaction was considerable, and he well knew that the prince's eager desire to bring it to a conclusion would ensure him his protection in the dilemma in which he stood. Emboldened by these considerations, the Jew pursued his point, and jostled the Norman Christian, without respect either to his descent, quality, or religion. The complaints of the old man, however, excited the indignation of the bystanders. One of these, a stout well-set yeoman, arrayed in Lincoln green, having 12 arrows stuck in his belt, with a baldric and badge of silver, and a bow of 6 feet length in his hand, turned short round, and while his countenance, which his constant exposure to weather had rendered brown as a hazelnut, grew darker with anger, he advised the Jew to remember that all the wealth he had acquired by sucking the blood of his miserable victims had but swelled him like a bloated spider, which might be overlooked while he kept in a corner, but would be crushed if it ventured into the light. This intimation, delivered in Norman English with a firm voice and a stern aspect, made the Jew shrink back, and he would have probably withdrawn himself altogether from a vicinity so dangerous, had not the attention of every one been called to the sudden entrance of Prince John, who at that moment entered the lists, attended by a numerous and gay train, consisting partly of laymen, partly of churchmen, as light in their dress, and as gay in their demeanor, as their companions. Among the latter was the prior of Jorvaulx, in the most gallant trim which a dignitary of the church could venture to exhibit. Fur and gold were not spared in his garments, and the points of his boots, out eroding the preposterous fashion of the time, turned up so very far, as to be attached, not to his knees merely, but to his very girdle, and effectually prevented him from putting his foot into the stirrup. This, however, was a slight inconvenience to the gallant abbot, who, perhaps, even rejoicing in the opportunity to display his accomplished horsemanship before so many spectators, especially of the fair sex, dispensed with the use of these supports to a timid rider. The rest of Prince John's retinue consisted of the favorite leaders of his mercenary troops, some marauding barons and profligate attendants upon the court, with several Knights Templars and Knights of St. John. It may be here remarked, that the knights of these two orders were accounted hostile to King Richard, having adopted the side of Philip of France in the long train of disputes which took place in Palestine betwixt that monarch and the lion-hearted King of England. It was the well-known consequence of this discord that Richard's repeated victories had been rendered fruitless, his romantic attempts to besiege Jerusalem disappointed, and the fruit of all the glory which he had acquired had dwindled into an uncertain truce with the Sultan Saladin. With the same policy which had dictated the conduct of their brethren in the Holy Land, the Templars and Hospitallers in England and Normandy attached themselves to the faction of Prince John, having little reason to desire the return of Richard to England, or the succession of Arthur, his legitimate heir. For the opposite reason, Prince John hated and contemned the few Saxon families of consequence which subsisted in England, and omitted no opportunity of mortifying and affronting them, being conscious that his person and pretensions were disliked by them, as well as by the greater part of the English commons, who feared farther innovation upon their rights and liberties, from a sovereign of John's licentious and tyrannical disposition. Attended by this gallant equipage, himself well mounted, and splendidly dressed in crimson and in gold, bearing upon his hand a falcon, and having his head covered by a rich fur bonnet, adorned with a circle of precious stones, from which his long curled hair escaped and overspread his shoulders, Prince John, upon a grey and high-mettled palfrey, caracoled within the lists at the head of his jovial party, laughing loud with his train, and eyeing with all the boldness of royal criticism the beauties who adorned the lofty galleries. Those who remarked in the physiognomy of the prince a dissolute audacity, mingled with extreme haughtiness and indifference to the feelings of others, could not yet deny to his countenance that sort of comeliness which belongs to an open set of features, well formed by nature, modeled by art to the usual rules of courtesy, yet so far frank and honest, that they seemed as if they disclaimed to conceal the natural workings of the soul. Such an expression is often mistaken for manly frankness, when in truth it arises from the reckless indifference of a libertine disposition, conscious of superiority of birth, of wealth, or of some other adventitious advantage, totally unconnected with personal merit. To those who did not think so deeply, and they were the greater number by 100 to 1, the splendor of Prince John's Reno, i.e. fur tippet, the richness of his cloak, lined with the most costly sables, his Moroccan boots and golden spurs, together with the grace with which he managed his palfrey, were sufficient to merit clamorous applause. In his joyous caracole round the lists, the attention of the prince was called by the commotion, not yet subsided, which had attended the ambitious movement of Isaac towards the higher places of the assembly. The quick eye of Prince John instantly recognized the Jew, but was much more agreeably attracted by the beautiful daughter of Zion, who, terrified by the tumult, clung close to the arm of her aged father. The figure of Rebecca might indeed have compared with the proudest beauties of England, even though it had been judged by as shrewd a connoisseur as Prince John. Her form was exquisitely symmetrical, and was shown to advantage by a sort of Eastern dress, which she wore according to the fashion of the females of her nation. Her turban of yellow silk suited well with the darkness of her complexion. The brilliancy of her eyes, the superb arch of her eyebrows, her well-formed aquiline nose, her teeth as white as pearl, and the profusion of her sable tresses, which, each arranged in its own little spiral of twisted curls, fell down upon as much of a lovely neck and bosom as a samar of the richest Persian silk, exhibiting flowers in their natural colors embossed upon a purple ground, permitted to be visible. All these constituted a combination of loveliness, which yielded not to the most beautiful of the maidens who surrounded her. It is true, that of the golden and pearl-studded clasps, which closed her vest from the throat to the waist, the three uppermost were left unfastened on account of the heat, which somewhat enlarged the prospect to which we allude. A diamond necklace, with pendants of inestimable value, were by this means also made more conspicuous. The feather of an ostrich, fastened in her turban by an agraffe set with brilliants, was another distinction of the beautiful Jewess, scoffed and sneered at by the proud dames who sat above her, but secretly envied by those who affected to deride them. "By the bald scalp of Abraham," said Prince John, "yonder Jewess must be the very model of that perfection, whose charms drove frantic the wisest king that ever lived."